gun patriotism is becoming more and more popular among economically hard-pressed farmers.
Traditionally strong, proud, independent farmers are losing their farms in record numbers.
We think as many as a million family farms were foreclosed on during the late 70s, early 80s. There was anger against the federal government's exploitation of farmers.
Violence starts to occur in the heartland because they were desperate. When Mr. Nixon was president, he encouraged farmers to plant fence row to fence row, and they did. But then, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, President Carter put an embargo on grain sales to the Soviet Union. And the result was the agricultural depression.
The federal government mustn't shirk its responsibility to help undo some of the damage that it created. We're doing a great deal to help farmers. But the federal government will not bail out every farmer hopelessly in debt. So today, I have vetoed this massive new bailout.
Ronald Reagan basically left the farmers to just go bankrupt. Far-right leaders saw a political opportunity. The first wave of the Patriot Movement was able to successfully mobilize farmers into this far-right movement, and they were willing to take up arms, and some of them did.
Everybody in the movement saw the land crisis, farm crisis, as the government and major corporations putting farmers into a financial bind, where the government is making war with the American people and selling us out.
I don't want to see our group or any group forced against their will into a confrontation.
I'm a former extremist from a group known as CSA, the Covenant, the Sword, and the Armor of the Lord in northern Arkansas back in the 70s and 80s. For me, it was like heaven on earth. The group was started originally by Jim Ellison to establish a community based upon the apocalypse.
God began to deal with us about the economic judgment, collapse, and upheaval that was coming upon all the world, and especially on this country.
And he said, but how are you going to protect yourself when it collapses and bad people want what you have?
Basically, the Bible says that we have the right to use whatever the enemy uses. And the enemy, of course, is going to have guns.
Fire!
We had never talked about guns before. We had never talked about defense. Over the next 18 months, we started buying guns, buying military equipment, and we trained so well that a magazine in those days called us the number one civilian SWAT team in the United States. The church kind of went to the background. Guns and the warfare went to the forefront. The first plan that we talked about was the Oklahoma City Federal Building. Sort of a quasi-member of the group, Richard Wayne Snell, he lived in Oklahoma, was having trouble with the IRS. Him and Jim went and cased the Murrah Building. There was a lot of federal offices in that building, so it seemed like a good target of various agencies being in that building. So we had our munitions guys start to develop a rocket launcher, and all the rockets would be shot at the same time toward the Murrah Building. One of the missiles exploded in the guy's hands that was building them, scarred his hands real bad. So we took that as a sign that from God that we weren't supposed to do that particular plan.
I was surprised as to the extent of violence of this group, believing that they were going to cause the collapse of the United States of America and that they were going to help create that collapse. We actually learned that Richard Wayne Snell, a member of the CSA, shot and killed a pawn shop owner in Texarkana, believing he was Jewish, had killed Lewis Bryan, a state police trooper, murdered. I believe that was in 84.
Got out of my van, and I shot Officer Bryant twice from the hip.
The death of Trooper Lewis Bryant was especially heartbreaking for Bill Clinton. While the governor was visibly shaken over the slaying, he was also angry.
You know, they don't have a right to go around carrying
weapons and taking the law in their hands and acting as if they're somehow playing God.
Snell got the death penalty. Snell's execution was to be on the night of April 19th, 1995, which happened to be the day the Oklahoma City Federal Building got bombed. In the movement, April 19th, of course, is what's called Patriot's Day. First shot fired during the American Revolution. Very special for the whole movement. Jim told me one time, he said, I will go down in history in the second American Revolution. In 84, I told Jim, I said, so you really want all this to start? He said, yes. I said, so build a bomb and we'll start the war. So we decided to go to find a good place to do the bombing. We found the gay church. We sort of had this stereotype image in our heads that there was just going to be this sexual orgy going on, which of course there wasn't. I start seeing people lift their hands up and lift their eyes up, look up and start worshiping God. And I identified with them. So instantly they ceased being homosexuals in my eyes and became Christians. And I couldn't kill Christians. Later, I'm trying to talk to God. And I said, Lord, I want to leave. You know, I can't handle this no more. And the Lord spoke to me and said, you can't leave.
It looks like a battle zone. Police and federal agents blockading the roads, surrounding the heavily armed compound of a white supremacist sect calling itself the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord. They want to arrest the leader, James Ellison, on an illegal weapons charge.
Covenant, Sword, the Arm of the Lord. They lived in log cabins. Every log cabin had a trap door. When you dropped through the trap door, you were in a foxhole with your weapon and ammunition ready. Federal officials, they really wanted to storm this compound, just like what later happened in Waco.
We knew that a frontal assault attack on that entity, a lot of people had died, and we didn't want that. I did not want that. My job is not to kill people. I know how to do it, but I don't want to do it. And I didn't want to get in a shootout in the Ozarks. They had murder on their mind, and they were all doing it for God. I found somebody I could talk to. Actually, he came to me. Kerry Noble.
He said, I want to make this plain. We are not going to shoot first. We don't want to kill anybody here. But if y'all shoot first, I've got a Huey helicopter. It's going to come up. It's got a 50 caliber machine gun. It's going to start shooting holes in all your buildings. And in 30 seconds, every man, woman, and child in your compound is going to be dead. So for 4 days, I went back and forth talking to Jim, talking to Danny. Finally, on the fourth day, Jim got that revelation that he could justify in his mind a higher purpose in surrendering. We get down there, and then Danny looks at Jim and says, I'm placing you under arrest, but I'm not going to handcuff you right now because I would not want to be handcuffed in front of my men. And I'm just bawling.
The four-day siege ended as quietly as it began. The FBI got more than it bargained for. Other weapons found at the camp read like an arsenal checklist: hand grenade casings, blasting caps, dynamite, and various handguns.
We found cyanide in huge barrels. They were going to poison the water supplies.
In addition to the arrest of CSA leader James Ellison by federal and state authorities,
Jim ended up taking a plea bargain on the weapons charges. So I got arrested, ended up plea bargaining, 5-year sentence. My dream for moving there had turned into a nightmare, but the movement continued to grow.
The White Power movement had come together every summer at the Aryan Nations World Congress in Hayden Lake, Idaho. In 1983, the movement adopted a number of key strategies, and it decided to declare war on the federal government.
There is nothing more that the white Aryan can do but obey the commandment of Yahweh his God and separate himself.
Blood, blood. The founding fathers shed their blood to give you this country.
politics could never, ever deliver the kinds of social changes they wanted. In the 80s, there is a major campaign of violence and crime carried out by this movement across the United States. Robbing armored cars, bombings of gay theaters, assassinations.
Last night, Alan Berg was killed in ambush, arriving at his Denver home. 10.45 caliber shell casings were near his body.
By 1987, the government believes it has a case that all of this activity represents an organized criminal conspiracy to overthrow the United States government.
Charges of sedition are filed against Reverend Butler and others.
In its opening statement, the government said it intends to prove that 10 of the defendants plotted to overthrow the government by force.
Seditious conspiracy is a hard charge to prove. Prosecutors have to show that they intended to overthrow the U.S. government and had the capacity to do so.
What the FBI now sees across the country is a national network of neo-Nazis and white supremacist groups whose goal is to purge this country of blacks, Jews, and other minorities.
One. Two, I want to say to hell with the federal government.
Louis Beam is really the intellectual architect of leaderless resistance. And I think this has been the biggest legacy of the white power movement and the reason it's been with us since 1983. Activists can work violently in common cause without direct communication with leaders. There are still leaders in leaderless resistance, but they're not culpable because you can't trace them to the individual violent actions.
I understood that that was their intent, but I also knew that an Arkansas jury would have a hard time convicting these folks of attempted overthrow of the United States government when they had no capacity really to do that.
That's why it's called a conspiracy. The thought was trying to overthrow the government. Actually, they couldn't do it, but they certainly tried.
The government had really bet the farm on this trial. They had used all of these other busts to kind of amass state's witnesses, and it fails spectacularly.
It was the first serious setback in the federal government's war against suspected white supremacist groups. 13 defendants were found not guilty of all charges, which included murder, robbery, and conspiracy to overthrow the government.
It was a tremendous defeat for the government. And it totally enabled the far-right movement. We're free to go do whatever we want to do. They tried. They missed. We have got them by the short hairs.
Sheila Beam passed out and had to be carried off by her husband, who now walks free.
Leaderless resistance was Louis Beam's idea, and he passed it along to everybody else in the movement. The best way to go after the government was not to have this organized CSA compound, but to have individuals.
Sinister plan,
Mind's controlled by unseen hand. Mind's key to unlock the lies, exposing darkness beneath the skies. We delve deep to find the truth, breaking free from UFO roots. Overlords tremble as knowledge grows, liberation's dawning as darkness goes. Behind the scenes, a sinister plan. Mind's controlled by unseen hands. Mind's key to unlock the lies, exposing darkness beneath the skies. We delve deep to find the truth, breaking free from UFO roots. Overlords tremble as knowledge grows, liberation's dawning as darkness goes. You'll see. You'll see.
Welcome back to Politics Parallax. We are here.
Hello, 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 welcome. It's Saturday. Oh my, we're on Saturday. Well, look at that. Look at that. Look at that. Well, welcome everybody on Saturday. Saturday. Well, I was going to save this for Sunday, but, my Saturday plans were ruined. I found out Devin wasn't doing Blackpilled tonight, so I said, well, you know, I might as well do it tonight. You know, I might as well do it tonight. So that's what we're doing. Now, I've been working on this for a little while today. It's interesting. It's interesting. I'd heard about this for quite a while. This is the Fort Smith Sedition Trial. So, in the 80s, in the late 80s, 88 specifically, interesting number choice for such an event. Well, in the late 80s, of course. There is the farm crisis. Now, the farm crisis gives way to a lot of this resistance. A lot of this resistance was born out of the pressure that was applied to your average white American during this time. They foreclosed on thousands of farms throughout the late 70s and early 80s. People felt under attack. The working yeoman farmer, as Matthews called it, felt under attack. So people started to organize to resist this. White people started to organize to resist this. Well, needless to say, the government did not appreciate this none too much. Not in the slightest. So, eventually a series of events led to a sedition trial where they tried to bring the key players, the most important figures, up for seditious conspiracy. Now, seditious conspiracy is not something you can just accuse somebody of. There has to be, like, some standards. It has to be an attempt to use violence to overthrow the government. You have to have the means to do it. I think there's another element I'm forgetting. But there are specific elements that need to be in place to qualify as sedition. So they tried very hard to do this, and it didn't quite play out the way that they were hoping. In fact, it backfired, and the government, as it were, said, well, they lost. They lost the trial. But the events around the trial and the people involved are still very interesting, and it plays a big role in the foundation of what we now know as white nationalism. And there are some people today who think that what is often referred to as 1.0 is irrelevant or doesn't matter or ha-ha, they're old or some stupid shit like that. Well, you wouldn't have almost any of this stuff without it. Consequently, and unsurprisingly, a lot of these same kind of individuals will have 88 in their name, which is pretty weird, given that that comes from David Lane, who is quote-unquote 1.0. So, I think it's important that we understand the history of this if we're going to be laying claim to its mantle if we're going to be laying claim to its mission, then our people that are doing that had better know what the fuck they're laying claim to. They'd better have some respect for where all this comes from. They better understand that if they achieve things in this regard, that there are people that have died for this. There are people that have gone to prison for their whole life for this. There have been big debts paid for this. There have been good people, very good people involved. There have been very bad people involved, as would be in any kind of political movement that's coming from a dissenting perspective. There are people that are heroes and people that are villains. We actually talked about a villain yesterday who was somebody that betrayed his people to the feds and then ultimately went on some rando shooting spree, I guess, and shot some rando Jews, I think. Yeah, I was trying to remember if there's a black involved. But anyway, point being, there are heroes and villains and good people and bad people. There are good motives and bad motives. There are authentic people, and there are glowies. Lots of glowies. Something we still have a very big problem with to this day. In fact, I would say it's even worse in a way, because now, since the way the internet works, with anonymity and all, you can't tell who's who. So you have no idea what you're dealing with. And it's way easier for them to infiltrate communities, scenes, organizations, groups, networks, chats, whatever it is they want to infiltrate. It's way easier, way easier. So with all this in mind, I think it is important that we understand the origins of all this, and that's what we're going to attempt to do today, as we often do when we do these Founder Series type ones. Now, this is a little bit weird to call this a Founder Series because it's not a founder, but in this is featured many a founder. There's multiple founders featured in this, including people that you might not know. So we're going to take a look at that, and we're going to try to understand everything we can about this. Now, one of the cool things is I was handed a documentary that's sort of the centerpiece of what I put together here. Shout out to AB from the Movement History channel. You can find Movement History on Rumble, Odyssey, and Telegram. So check out Movement History. Annie Waffen, what's up? It says, good to see you on a Saturday. Well, good to see you on a Saturday, Annie Waffen. Annie Waffen. Oh, I didn't do it right. I might get a lecture. Right. So anyway. Anyway. This is important to know. It seems like a very specific history, but it is still very important to the whole overall story of everything that happened. Additionally, in this, there is a very, very strong representation of identity people, Christian identity folk. In fact, for the main piece of this whole story, it is shot. This is a documentary created by the wife of Pete Peters. I forget what her first name was, but she created this documentary called Sedition USSA Style. And they did a really good job for the time. I mean, given the kind of editing equipment, camera equipment, the sort of thing that they would have to use, you know, it's very, very impressive. In that context, things were a little harder to do media like that back then. They didn't have, you know, you couldn't just throw it in the digital editor and start non-linear editing. But now you can, of course, you can do that. So it's a little bit easier to do that. Plus, you know, we have 4K cameras and this kind of crap, drones and GoPros and all sorts of gizmos that they didn't have in those days. But nonetheless, there's some very cool footage in this. Interviews that I'd never seen before. Interviews with a lot of the guys from the Order. A lot of the, I forget what his name is. It's Ken something. But he was a movement lawyer that was a lawyer for Louis Beam. And there's many of these kind of people in here where you're going to see interviews. I didn't know where these, I'd never seen these before. So it was really quite the find. I mean, kind of a connoisseur of this kind of history, this kind of niche history of original white nationalism, you might say. I feel excited when I find something that I'd never seen before. So I was quite stoked to find some of this stuff. let's go ahead and get started on it. I don't know. We're going to like push for 4 hours or whatever. This is, we'll do it till it's done. We'll do it till it's done. Get her done. Thank you, Andy Waffen, for starting us off on support for tonight. Remember, it's always good to support the show. If you want to see more of the show, if you want it to exist in the future, it's always free to support the show by sharing the link. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not the same, but it's helpful nonetheless. There is, before we start, I'll say there's an anonymous option if you have Monero and you don't want to be noticed by Glowies, for example, of which there are a ton creeping around. Just a fucking unbelievable amount. So if you don't want, if you're concerned about that, we have anonymous support options and many others. All the same, please, no matter what, free or not, share the link. Thank you, Sepp Dietrich said Sherry Peters. Yes, thank you. Thank you. That's her name. I don't know why that didn't come up, but your name came up, but not the comment. Anyway, Sepp Dietrich said Sherry Peters is her name. Thank you. So let's go ahead and take a look and see what we got. Let's see what we got. So I'm going to go ahead and start us here with a news piece on it. But before we do that, actually, that reminds me of what I wanted to do. I had a little bit of a description from the Encyclopedia of Arkansas, because this all happened in Arkansas in Sebastian County. Let me go ahead and I'm going to go ahead and robo voice this one because I got a little bit of a frog in the throat. But let's just go ahead and try this because this is cool. This actually kind of gives you a really good a really good overview understanding of what all is involved and what they were trying to do. And you'll see. It's a very cool introduction to it.
For 7 weeks, beginning on February 16, 1988, Fort Smith was the site of a major trial in which a 12-person jury sought to determine the guilt or innocence of 14 right-wing radicals who were charged with a variety of crimes, most prominently conspiracy to engage in sedition. After hearing from a total of almost 200 witnesses, the jury found none of the defendants guilty. In the almost two-month-long proceeding, federal prosecutors presented evidence intended to prove that 10% of the defendants had conspired and plotted to overthrow the federal government, while also asserting that the others were guilty of trying to kill a federal judge and a Federal Bureau of Investigation agent, according to the scenario laid out by Assistant U.S. Attorney Stephen N. Snyder in a July 1983 meeting in Hayden Lake, Idaho. The leaders of a number of racist and neo-Nazi groups began the planning and implementation of a program that would ultimately include robberies, bombings, and murders as part of a conspiracy to create a white Aryan nation in the United States. While like-minded, the defendants in the case were geographically diverse. Robert E. Miles, a former Grand Dragon of the Michigan Ku Klux Klan, Louis Ray Beam of Houston, the former Grand Dragon of the Texas Klan, Richard G. Butler, the one-time leader of the Aryan Nations in Idaho, Richard Scutari of New York, Bruce Carroll Pierce of Washington State, Andrew Virgil Barnhill of Florida, Artie McBrady of Arkansas, David Eden Lane of Denver, Colorado, Lambert Miller of Missouri, David Michael McGuire of Illinois, Robert Smalley of Fort Smith, Richard Wayne Snell of Oklahoma, and William Wade and his son Ivan Ray Wade, both of Smithville. Many had had previous legal trouble. In fact, at the time of the trial, Scutari, Pierce, Barnhill, McBrady, and Lane were all in prison serving lengthy terms for racketeering, with Pierce and Lane also serving additional time for their involvement in the death of popular Denver radio personality Alan Berg. Snell was also in prison, having been convicted of two murders, one of which had resulted in a death sentence. In their effort to secure convictions on the charges of conspiracy, the prosecution had to prove that 10 of the defendants had met and planned to overthrow the government. In buttressing the case for the conspiracy whose events the indictment asserted took place between July and April, federal prosecutors also charged the 10 defendants with a total of specific and overt acts, including robbery, counterfeiting.
I don't know why it's skipping the names, but it took place between July 1983 and April 1985, allegedly. And it said they charged the 10 defendants with a total of 119 specific and overt acts, including robbery, counterfeiting,
and the attempted murder of federal officials, offenses for which the accused could have faced maximum sentences of 20 years in prison and fines of $20,000. Meanwhile, 5 of the 14 were charged with conspiring to murder Judge H. Franklin Waters, the chief federal judge for the Western District of Arkansas, as well as FBI agent Jack D. Knox. Given that the accused were all reported to be members of white supremacist groups, with some having held positions of leadership in their individual organizations, The government hoped that the successful prosecution of this group would go far in breaking up the wide-ranging neo-Nazi network investigators had uncovered, while many speculated that the roots of this apparent insurgency could be found in the June 1983 shooting death of outspoken tax protester Gordon Call in Arkansas. Subsequent investigations seemed to indicate that it had become more far-flung than the Posse Comitatus group in which Call was a central figure. Indeed, while some of the incidents that were a part of the government's case were already known, and in fact had resulted in some earlier convictions, ties to a wide range of Klan and white nationalist groups were discovered. And plans to bomb federal buildings, assassinate federal officials, commit robberies, and engineer jailbreaks of imprisoned compatriots were all at one time or another planned as part of the alleged effort to overthrow the government. Two, the government prosecutors said that white supremacist groups robbed banks and armored cars of $4.1 million, noting that, as of the trial, $1 million had still not been recovered. The presiding judge in the trial was District Court Judge Morris Arnold, who oversaw the seating of an all-white jury of 10 men and 2 women. Once the trial began, the prosecution offered 113 witnesses, while the defense countered with 79. In a break from standard legal practice, some of the defendants delivered their own opening statements, while others left it to their attorneys to offer their first defense. While the prosecution systematically laid out a scenario detailing the meetings and actions that constituted the alleged conspiracy, Richard G. Butler's attorney sought to refute the charges, asserting that the issue was not one of conspiracy but of freedom of speech, and that the group's effort to replace one government with another was little more than democratically based free speech. About a month into the trial, Judge Arnold ruled that there was insufficient evidence to continue the prosecution of Robert Smalley, who had been charged with seditious conspiracy. However, that interruption was followed by a continuing presentation of evidence and testimony until early April, when the jury began its deliberations. After 4 days, the jury members told Judge Arnold that they were deadlocked, but he refused to accept that, and sent them back for further deliberations. The following day, April 7, 1988, the jury returned a verdict of not guilty against the 13 individuals charged with conspiring to overthrow the U.S. government.
There's some really dramatic footage, too, when they get acquitted. The wife of Louis Beam faints, and he picks her up and carries her out, which is very fucking Chadley. It's very kind of Gone with the Wind. It's pretty cool.
Miles, Butler, Beam, Scutari, Pierce, Barnhill, McBrearty, Lane, and Snell had all been acquitted of the charges of seditious conspiracy, while Scutari and Barnhill were acquitted of transporting stolen money, and Snell, Miller, McGuire, and the Wades, father and son, were acquitted of conspiracy to commit murder. The trial results led to many post-verdict interpretations, analyses, and responses. One defendant proclaimed that the jury's verdict meant that religious freedom is still alive in the United States, while some observers opined that federal prosecutors had been duped by star witness Glenn Miller, whose ultimately unconvincing testimony had been the product of a highly favorable plea deal. Meanwhile, the other major prosecution witness, former Arkansas white supremacist leader John Ellison, who was already serving time in prison for racketeering, offered less than compelling testimony. Meanwhile, many saw the verdict as a reflection of disturbing changes in the cultural landscape.
From what I understand, Ellison flipped and became a witness for the prosecution, for the feds.
Urban League President John Jacobs commented that the verdict was the latest example of the resurgence of racism in the United States, while Burton Levinson, national chairman of the Anti-Defamation League, called the verdicts a real setback in the war against organized hate. Indeed, the verdicts proved a major setback to efforts to address the increasingly aggressive efforts of the white nationalist movement, one whose profile and outreach would only continue to grow.
All right, so stop right there. So that's a pretty good introduction. Thank you, Mr. Robot, for reading that. Helping me do it the lazy way, I guess. Sometimes it's good on your throat to just let it read it. Plus, you don't stumble over words. All right, let's get into it. Let's get into it. So there's some really cool stuff. I really like some of the footage in this because it's stuff you've never seen before. I've never seen it before anyway. Let's go ahead and get started. So this is some local news coverage announcing the trial and kind of giving a quick overlay. A little bit similar to what just happened, but a little bit more specific with also cool footage.
It's called seditious conspiracy, and even the government admits it's not an easy thing to prosecute. Its definition is to attempt to overthrow the government by force, violence, and armed revolution. Opponents call it the talking crime, and the KKK says it's the government's way of keeping tabs on those who speak out against its policies. 10 of the 14 men on trial are faced with a seditious conspiracy charge. If convicted, they could be punished with up to 20 years in prison and a $20,000 fine. The three the government are really after, although not openly admitting it, are 69-year-old Richard Butler, 63-year-old Robert Miles, and 41-year-old Louis Ray Beam. It was these three that the Klan held a series of protests for in western Arkansas just prior to the trial. There are others, of course, most of them already serving long prison sentences for other crimes. Two Smithville, Arkansas men, Bill and Ivan Wade, are charged with conspiracy to assassinate federal officials, which carries a sentence of up to life in prison. The trial, although not as long as first projected, has been lengthy. At one point, federal judge Morris Buzz Arnold told prosecutors they had better add more substance to their case or he would have to consider a mistrial. The government recovered, but to what extent may only be known with the final verdict. If Butler, Miles, and Beam are convicted, it would strike a serious blow to the white supremacist movement. If found innocent, they would...
That's Thomas Robb right there. He's, I think he's currently the leader of the Klan in Harrison.
...will claim victory, and as one of them put it, they'll continue to fight for their race. David Davis, Channel 7 News.
In Fort Smith, Arkansas, after a seven-week trial, 13 white supremacists charged with plotting to overthrow the government and set up a new nation of their own have been found not guilty. ABC's Ron Claiborne is in Fort Smith.
How about now?
The defendants left the courtroom triumphant and defiant.
One, I want to praise Yahweh's holy and precious name.
Notice what they do, though, right? When they get coverage, they always label them white supremacist. it's that kind of characterization that sets the mind of the viewer in such a way that it prejudices the viewer right out of the gate. So even when they say something very sensible, very relatable, there's less chance that the listener, the average person listener, is going to just take in what they say. It triggers a sort of defensive algorithm in the brains of the average person. It's been installed, of course, over decades since the Second World War ended, really.
Two, I want to say to hell with the federal government.
The federal court jury cleared all 13 defendants of charges of sedition, conspiracy to assassinate federal officials, and interstate transportation of stolen money.
We thought we had met the elements. And we thought we'd proved it beyond a reasonable doubt, but apparently we hadn't.
The defendants are members of the extreme right-wing white supremacist group, the Aryan Nation. They advocated establishing a separate nation for whites only in the Pacific Northwest.
But they understand they want to be separate from us, we want to be separate from them.
The government had argued that the defendants had intended to realize this vision by overthrowing the government, by sabotaging public works, poisoning water supplies, and killing their enemies.
Damn.
The government's case was based largely on the testimony of James Ellison, former leader of an ultra-right paramilitary group, now serving 20 years for racketeering. He claimed that he attended a 1983 meeting where the plot to overthrow the government was hatched.
But the jury didn't buy it. Civil rights groups say they are concerned that the verdict will now lead to a resurgence by white supremacist groups. Ron Claiborne, ABC News, Fort Smith, Arkansas.
I do notice that every time they have a white supremacist group, as they put it, they always have a black out in front of it. Like, there's always a black newsman that's going to come out and present this information. This is the start of the bulk of today's show. This is a documentary, as I mentioned earlier. This was made by Sherry Peters. She's the wife of Pete Peters. The duplicate name, Pete Peters, who is an identity minister. It actually opens with what he has to say. You get a sense of what he's like, too, which is pretty cool. Because I was looking, some people were imploring me to do one of these on identity founders. My only pushback to that was that, hey, well, it's very hard to find footage on these people. Like, there's not a great deal of footage on them, but this is some, so that's pretty cool. I actually ended up thinking that was the case for never mind, forget it. All right, let's get into it. What the?
years ago, going to CSU as a student. And then when I went off to Bible college later in years, I wondered why it was that the Caesars were persecuting Christians and the Herods. Today I understand. Because true Christianity promotes righteousness, justice, and says God is just, God is king, all must submit to his rule and authority, for he is above all rule and authority. And as long as the churches want to play church within the four walls of their church building, they'll have no problem with a government or government agencies or bureaucrats who want to get out of their line and their position and begin to promote unrighteousness. But where the problem develops is when you are willing to step out and say, hold it, you can't do that. This is what God's law says. About, what was last, when was it? Last February or January? Last January or February, we were talking about some things in our house. Specifically, the Fort Smith trial on sedition that took place this year.
Uh-oh, my mic volume is one? No! That's not good. This is wacky, man. Like, different profiles I have. Oh, yeah, there it is. Okay, I see what's going on. That's weird, man. Different profiles. I should probably just start using one. Just try to pack it all into one profile, even if it's two different brandings, I guess. I should be better. That's too hot. Too hot. Too hot, baby. All right. Test, 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 test. Probably better. Do like 14. Test, 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 test. That should be good. Okay.
Let me tell you why it was of interest to me. Because it had come back to me in the way of a report that my name was one of the names that kept coming before the grand jury that gave the indictments for this particular trial regarding sedition. That has a way of gaining your attention in a particular event. If you analyze it, Christ was being tried for sedition, saying that there was a king higher than Caesar. And so was Paul. And although we did not agree with the men that we heard were being tried with, had nothing in common with them as such, didn't know most of them. I did know the two Arkansas farmers that you're going to see in this video. I knew that they had one thing in common, and that was, even though some of them were in an area that I wouldn't necessarily agree with, they all wanted the righteousness of Christ. And they were standing up against unrighteousness, and also they were doing something else that is almost becoming a crime today. They were just standing up in defense of the white race. And lo and behold, that is becoming a crime today.
Oh, it's even more of a crime now. As Frank said, too, is that, like, this stuff was bad then, but now it's, like, the same shit just on steroids. Same stuff, just, like, 10 times worse. I think that's probably quite an accurate assessment.
And we found that they had these common denominators. I didn't know what I could do about it. My wife became very burdened. This has happened before in our marriage. I can remember years ago when I had a very successful career with the federal government, was making good money. She became burdened that I should become a preacher. But I don't want to be a preacher. Don't bring it up to me anymore. I got good reason not to be. In fact, I didn't even want to go to church anymore. And so she didn't bring it up. She just began to pray about it. It's a very, very effective method. Because all of a sudden I was burdened. And I had to go out and become a preacher. Well, she decided not to bring it up to me anymore, but she prayed about this sedition trial. And she had to pray that if it was God's will, that I would be receptive to the idea of making a documentary on this trial. And so she brought it up to me one day, and, you know, what can I do about it? This is the attitude that a lot of times we have when we see unrighteousness going on. Well, what do you think about making a video? I didn't know why, but it seemed...
How is that, Bob?
...seemed like a terrific idea. I had no idea how you make a video. We didn't have the equipment for it. We'd never done it. But from that time on, everything just began to fall in place. We found out that Steve Ray, our right-hand man, Scriptures for America, is not only talented in many other areas, but he's a very, very talented cameraman, can run editing equipment, has went to school for it, has studied it, and he's wanted to do this before, hasn't he, in his life? We didn't have any idea that was the kind of man we had in our midst. Well, what are you going to do for equipment? Well, I figured we'd rent a camera. I figured that out when I priced the cameras. The camera's prices were unbelievable. In the course of trying to find a camera to rent, we heard about a small corporation in Denver that had some video equipment. And so we just on a lark decided to investigate it. And we found equipment that was brand new, 1 year old, had been used only once. We checked out the purchase price and where it was purchased. And it was top of the line. And not only was it a camera, but it was editing equipment. It was mics. It was stands. It was a small mini studio that was not for rent, but for sale. They had paid well over $40,000 for it within the last 12 months, and they had a price tag on it. And next came a couple miracles. One, they accepted our offer of, well, less than half of that. And number two, a man sent us a very, very large tithe check. He had sold a valuable piece of real estate, and it all happened the same time. And lo and behold, we were in the video business.
People had mentioned the volume kind of goes up and down a bit. I think, as somebody said in the chat, it is an old VHS thing, because this is an old VHS copy. I do my best to try to repair the audio of these things. Sometimes the sound suppression probably makes it worse, but it gets rid of all the kind of hissing stuff that you get from old VHS copies of video. One thing I can try is I can try doing the auto gain. That might actually help. It might have the software kind of adapt to the lows and highs. I'll give that a try. Maybe it'll tell me if it's worse. Turn that on now and see if that's any worse.
Business. And Steve was like a kid in the candy store with all this equipment. I had no idea what it was all about. Then comes the trip, the expense of going down there. We send a crew down to begin to report on this. We had no idea how the trial was going to turn out, had no idea what we were going to find. And my wife took on the entire project because there's no way I could, and she was the one that had the burden. And she's done a remarkable job. I found out that in the video industry and in making documentaries, normally you have, first of all, a large sum of money for a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you have grants from such liberal sources as the Rockefeller Foundation, this type of thing. Secondly, you'd have at least a year to 2 years. And Sherry and Steve did this video documentary in 9 months with what seemed like a lot of money to us, but was just a drop in the bucket compared to the industry. And they did all of this while they took care of all their other activities. And not only that, I don't have time to go into it, but it became very dangerous down there. We found out that the media boys do not like other people coming onto their turf. We write about this in our newsletter and how this particular documentary is going to be put out. Sherry, are there some things you want to say before we say that I'm missing?
I just want to check.
Yes, you're the second group to see this. Some of the men that are in prison are the ones that saw it first. We showed it to them to get their feelings on it. And again, the question, why would a church be involved with something like this? The reason the communists are scared of true Christianity is because when there is a revival, people rise up and they oppose injustice. And they say, enough is enough. You are not God, even though you'd like to set yourself up. The state is God. And so we were just burdened to make this. We don't know where it's going to go, what's going to happen with it. I got a quote here from Solzhenitsyn in his book, Gulag. How many have heard that book, Gulag, Solzhenitsyn? He said, universal innocence also gave rise to the universal failure to act. Maybe they won't take you. Maybe it will be all blown over.
Mm.
The majority sit quietly and dare to hope. Since you aren't guilty, then how can they arrest you? It's a mistake. They're already dragging you along by the collar, and you keep on exclaiming to yourself, it's a mistake. They're setting things straight. They'll set things straight and let me out. Others are being arrested en masse. And that's a bothersome fact. But in those other cases, there is always some dark area. Maybe he was guilty. But as for you, you are obviously innocent. You still believe that the organs are humanly logical institutions, that they will set things straight and let you out. Why then should you run? And how can you resist right then? After all, you'll only make your situation worse. You'll make it more difficult for them to sort out the mistake. And it isn't just that. You don't put up any resistance. You even walk down the stairs on tiptoes as you're ordered to do so your neighbors won't hear. At what exact point, then, should one resist? When one's belt is taken away? When one is ordered to face into a corner? When one crosses the threshold of one's home? This video documentary is our small measure of resistance. As I said, in comparison to the industry, they have all the camera and the equipment, and they have the major networks. They have everything. This, in comparison, is a small little tiny pebble. But the enemy has long since learned, since the times of David and Goliath, how effective a pebble can be when it's put in the sling of the remnant. So we made this video documentary to put it in the sling of the remnant, and we'll see what happens to it. It's called Sedition USSA. I think you'll find that Sherry and Steve did a superb job. I had nothing to do with it. It's their work, and I commend my wife for doing it.
This film is dedicated to the many American men and women who have bled and died in fighting for the liberties of a free and sovereign nation. Our forefathers, hundreds of years ago, came to this country in order to have their personal and religious freedoms. Most lived sacrificial lives in order to secure liberties for the heritage of their children and their children's children. And today, it's no different than 200 years ago. Men and women of deep faith in their Creator and love for the heritage of their country and their people are still willing to sacrifice and stand firm for the convictions within them. Even today, 1988, many men and women within the United States of America are boldly and courageously resisting what they consider to be a government out of control and unanswerable to the people. It's got a very 1980s vibe. I almost feel like we're watching They Live. It's got a They Live kind of feeling. Interesting. Oh, one more. Sedition held link to, quote, hate mongering. Jewish sermons give comment on trial in Washington. Wow. Look at how old that is. Way before the 80s. Christians being fed to the lions. Louis Beam. Set on a flag, a nation in distress. by Bebes.
It's so refreshing to look into these bright faces. Their purity of heart and mind refreshes me after spending so many months with my mind in the stench of the government's activities. The time spent in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and the research I've done the past few months have enlightened me even more as to why I feel distressed with the direction of my country and of my people. February 16, 1988, Fort Smith, Arkansas became the scene for the third major attempt of the United States government to prosecute men for the charges of seditious conspiracy. 10 men stood trial for seditious conspiracy, and 4 men stood trial for conspiracy to murder federal officials, the first time in the history of our country for anyone to be charged with conspiracy to murder without anyone being harmed. Believing I had come to see history in the making and justice to be served in the Western District of Arkansas, I was unaware I would be undergoing such a re-educating experience. I found one of the many peculiar things surrounding the sedition trial was the fact our government was trying 14 men on 4 different counts at one time.
Well, it is a very complex case simply because there are so many defendants. There are 14 defendants, and they're not all charged under the same conspiracy. Only 10 are charged with seditious conspiracy. Another section of the indictment includes a conspiracy to assassinate a federal judge.
This is Kirk Lyons, as you can see. He was a movement lawyer early on for what now is, I think, somewhat derisively called 1.0. I'm not really that big of a fan of that. I mean, I don't even have a personal dog in that fight per se, but I'm not a huge fan of the 1.0, 2.0, 3.0 stuff. It's just like it separates it up when it really is just one thing, really. What we call white nationalism is what? What is it really? What is the actual purpose of that? What is it meant to do? What is it there for? It's supposed to be a fight for white rights. It's supposed to be a fight for the future of white people. And our own countries, for that matter. I don't know that that's broken up into, like, stages like it's fucking software, okay? This is not like software with little updates. You know, I don't know if I like that. And now that I think about it, I'm not such a fan. Just gotta say, now that I give it some thought, I'm not so hot on that because it's not really different, is it? The only thing that's different is the generations for which it is happening in. But the fact that this has been going on, certainly hot and heavy since the end of the Second World War, but you know, in sort of different forms and under different names before that, but the fact that it's been going on for this long, and that there's never been anything that I think you might say resembles a resolution. It's a continuing fight. It's a battle that still rages today. In some ways, it's better today. In some ways, it's worse. Things have certainly changed. In these days, the only people that were talking about the Jewish power problem and everything related to that were white nationalists. I think today it globalized due to what happened in Palestine. This is something that a lot of people in this tradition, in our tradition, I guess, are not necessarily happy with. I don't think it's all bad. I mean, I really don't, and I think that these things can be separate. I think that the fight for white sovereignty and a future for our people can be different from opposition to Jewry. In fact, it might even be better that way. If you really think about it, whenever you have somebody in the mainstream that talks about Nazis, they think that National Socialism is just like fuck Jews. They think that that's all there is to it. And I don't think that's accurate. I mean, that's a part of it, but it's a part of it, and it's a core part of it only because that's who was fucking up the country. That's who was doing the damage. That's who was fucking the country up and the race. And still is, obviously. But I don't think those things have to be wed at the hip. You know, I think it can be a possibility, quite a real possibility, that those things could be different. I don't think we necessarily need to be defined by who we oppose. In fact, we might actually be more productive if we weren't exclusively defined by what we oppose. That might even be an error as far as our mission goes.
And yet another part of the conspiracy involves, interstate,
transportation
of stolen money. So you've got really three trials here involving 14 men, and that's what makes it so complicated to a layman, to an attorney, or to the jury, is how to separate all this when all the evidence is in, so that each man can essentially get that separate trial within the trial that he's entitled to.
Why would our government try these 14 men at the same time?
If they can show that all of these people fit in somehow, then it's just, they make the case that it's logical that they all be tried together for the same act, even though theoretically they're all being tried separately. It's convenient. It will make it easier for them to get a conviction.
I think it's not for judicial economy, but I think it's to increase their chances for a conviction.
Why does it increase their chances?
They're going to paint all the defendants with the same brush.
The four defendants involved in count four of the indictment, conspiracy to murder, tried for months to sever their trial from the 10 charged with seditious conspiracy, with no success. Why are you two being tried with these other 12?
We really don't understand. It was our opinion that this should have been severed, counts one and count four severed, because we do not feel that we belong in a seditious conspiracy and have put in motions and so forth challenging this. But the court did not see fit to honor those motions for severance.
I had to wonder, if our government was wanting an honest and fair trial for these men, why not try each defendant separately? Would justice not be served more favorably by allowing each one their own trial?
Very definitely. Very definitely. Some of them could be tried jointly. I don't argue that proposition. But I think it'd be better off for everyone if there were separate trials in a lot of these areas.
The actual sedition indictment read as follows. From on or about July 1983 and continuously thereafter, up to and including April 1985, in the Western District of Arkansas and elsewhere, a group of persons willfully and knowingly combined, conspired, confederated, and agreed together with each other to overthrow, put down, and to destroy by force the government of the United States and form a new Aryan nation. The 14 men on trial were as follows. Robert Edward Miles, pastor of the Mountain Church of Jesus Christ in Cahokia, Michigan. Richard Gert Butler, pastor of Aryan Nations Church, Hayden Lake, Idaho. Louis Ray Beam, Jr., computer salesman and bulletin board operator. Bruce Carroll Pierce, a member of the Notorious Order, presently serving over 250 years in a federal penitentiary.
So, like I mentioned earlier at the very beginning, if you're just joining us, we are, of course, going over the Fort Smith Sedition Trial, as the title would suggest. What I mentioned earlier was that there are some really cool interviews in this. Interviews I'd never seen anywhere else, actually. So, I think that's really kind of found treasure as far as this history goes.
Richard Joseph Scutari, also a member of the order, presently serving 60 years in a federal penitentiary. Andrew Virgil Barnhill, order member.
I believe Mr. Scutari was released at this point.
Presently serving 40 years in a federal penitentiary. Artie McBrady, alleged order member, presently serving 40 years in a federal penitentiary. David Eden Lane, order member, presently serving over 150 years in a federal penitentiary. Richard Wayne Snell, presently on death row in an Arkansas federal penitentiary for the murder of an Arkansas state trooper and a pawn shop owner. Lambert Miller, on trial in Fort Smith, Arkansas.
That was some dumb shit, okay? I mean, generally murder is kind of dumb shit, but anyway, beyond that, like, he shot some pawn shop owner that he figured was a Jew for some reason, and this guy was just some random fucking pawn shop owner. That's some dumb shit. Like, that's bad. That's real bad. I mean, you know, beyond the general murder thing.
For conspiracy to murder federal officials. Robert Neil Smalley, again, on trial in Fort Smith, Arkansas, for conspiracy to murder federal officials. David Michael McGuire, youngest of all defendants, standing trial in Fort Smith for conspiracy to murder federal officials. William Wade, Ivan Wade, father and son, Arkansas farmers, presently filed a lawsuit against the FBI for what they called a cover-up in the murder of Arkansas Sheriff Gene Matthews and tax protester Gordon Call. The sedition law is of immense importance and goes far beyond the arresting and trying of individuals for, perhaps, some otherwise illegal act. According to Bouvier's Law Dictionary, sedition may be defined as a revolt against legitimate authority, the raising of commotions and disturbances in the state, or the advocacy or suggestion by word, act, or writing of public disorder or resistance to the government. Again, Bouvier's Law Dictionary defines conspiracy, a combination of two or more persons by some concerted action to accomplish some criminal or unlawful purpose, not in itself criminal or unlawful means.
And thus a seditious conspiracy is a conspiracy that with the thought of undermining something, a government, an institution.
Does there have to be physical violence involved for it to be sedition?
As far as a legal opinion, our law is the seditious conspiracy statute is if the intent of that seditious conspiracy is to undermine, oppose, put down, or overthrow the United States government by force. And that seditious conspiracy has to manifest itself in some overt act that furthers that conspiracy.
The whole theory of sedition is that a government has a right to protect itself. That sounds logical at first glance, but if you stop and think about it, theoretically, we're supposed to be the government.
I had to wonder if...
That's true. You know, it's funny because, like, if you really think about all this, think about the spirit of the founding fathers of America and all this sort of stuff. Well, all that crap you were taught in elementary school and middle school and all the schools, all the way up. What were you taught about America? What kind of government is it supposed to be? That we're going to fight by the people, for the people, all this sort of stuff. Well, if it's not, what then is supposed to happen? What was it that Jefferson said? What did he say? Source of this. Wow. Way more than I was looking for. The common quote that's attributed to Jefferson is, "The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants." Now, this comes from... Yeah, that's whack. Yeah, it gave a false citation there. It's written in a letter to William Smith, 1787. So it says in the letter, it says, I do not know whether it is to yourself or Mr. Adams that I give my thanks for the copy of the new Constitution. I beg leave, though, you to place them where due. It will be yet 3 weeks before I shall receive them from America. They are very good articles in it, and very bad. I do not know which preponderate. What we have lately read in the history of Holland and the chapter of the Strafholder would have sufficed to set me against a chief magistrate eligible for a long duration if I had ever been disposed towards one. And what we have always read of elections, the elections of Polish kings, should have forever excluded the idea of one continuable for life. Wonderful is the effect of impudent and preserving lying. The British ministry have so hired their gazetteers to repeat and model into every form lies about our being in anarchy that the world has at length believed them. The English nation has believed them. The ministers themselves have come to believe them. And what is more wonderful, we have believed them ourselves. Yet where does this anarchy exist? Where did it ever exist, except in the single instance of Massachusetts? Shocker, right? And can history produce an instance of a rebellion so honorably conducted? I say nothing of its motives. They were founded in ignorance, not wickedness. God forbids we should ever be 20 years without such a rebellion. The people cannot be all and always well informed. The part which is wrong will be discontented in proportion to the importance of the facts they misconceive. If they remain quiet under such misconceptions, it is a lethargy, the forerunner of death to the public liberty. We have had 13 states independent 11 years. There has been one rebellion. I mean, he must be talking about the whiskey rebellion. That comes to one rebellion in a century and a half for each state. What country before ever existed a century and a half without a rebellion? And what country can preserve its liberties if their rulers are not warned from time to time that their people preserve the spirit of resistance? Let them take arms. The remedy is to set them right as to facts, pardon and pacify them. What signify a few lives lost in a century or two? The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is its natural manure. Our convention has been too much impressed by the insurrection of Massachusetts. And in the spur of the moment, they are setting up a kite with K-I-T-E, to keep the hen yard in order. I hope in God this article will be rectified before the new Constitution is accepted. That's the whole portion of the letter, anyway. I don't know if that's that's the entirety of the letter. That's where the famous tree of liberty must be watered from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. That's where that comes from. But as you can see, this kind of mentality was not, it was native to this very country's establishment from the beginning. This is something that the current powers that be always are very eager to forget as fast as they can. No, it was K-I-T-E. There was a T, not a K. I think in 1787, it actually was largely a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant-ruled country. I think there was actually very little Jewish power in 1787, at least in America. They were doing pretty well in Europe, but they were not really established here in America. That wasn't really until the turn of the century, in the late 1800s there, where they really got entrenched. But, you know, there was always some. There was always Sephardics in the South. I mean, that's who brought on all of our slave trading. You know, that's who brought that shit in. So they put that noose around our neck early on, with the bringing those slaves in from Africa. lot of them came routed through Puerto Rico. Yeah, just, you know, that sugar cane ain't going to raise itself.
After verbally criticizing the actions of our government over a cup of coffee, could one be considered a seditious conspirator? If we consider the very document that declared this nation free from the tyranny of England, the Declaration of Independence would have to be considered the most seditious of all, and those men who signed it to be considered seditious conspirators. We as American citizens are actually commanded in this document that if we see our government usurping its authority, it's our right, nay, our duty, to overthrow such a government. Immediately following the founding of this nation, our forefathers were concerned with our people being oppressed by a power-hungry government, but unfortunately to no avail. For within the United States, sedition laws were placed on the books at an early date. And for almost 200 years, concerned American citizens have worked at having this law rescinded. In 1797, John Adams was elected president by a majority of only 3 votes, after a hard-fought battle with Thomas Jefferson, who became vice president. Adams was a Federalist. Jefferson was a Republican. They disagreed violently on policies and became bitter enemies. In this turmoil, Jefferson defeated Adams in 1801. During the interim, in 1798, the Federalists enacted a sedition law on the pretext of controlling pro-French sentiment in the United States, but actually used it to harass, persecute, and imprison political opponents who had helped Jefferson in the previous election. They accused their victims of supporting France. A group of writers, speakers, and editors, all favorable to Jefferson, were sent to prison. The first victim of the Sedition Act was Matthew Lyon, a member of Congress from Vermont. He operated a newspaper. Writing editorially, he accused Adams of manifesting a continual grasp for power, an unbound thirst for ridiculous pomp, foolish adulation, and selfish avarice. After the initial flurry of arresting and imprisoning individuals for opposing the federal government, the states of Kentucky and Virginia passed a remarkable series of resolutions severely denouncing the sedition law as unconstitutional. It is readily seen that the international banking cartel and those striving for total world control were represented in the argument. The Federalists were closely tied to the plutocratic government of England, with its Bank of England, founded in 1694, plutocratic being the government ruled by the wealthy. Because the people of America stood up against the power of a one-world plutocratic government, the whole idea of trying someone for sedition in the United States was forgotten. The demands of the First Amendment rights prevailed, and Americans were able to live with freedom and liberty for at least a few decades. In the early part of the 1940s, you were on trial by the United States government for sedition. Would you just briefly tell us about the circumstances leading up to that trial?
Very good. I was a member of the America First Committee. I was a ghostwriter for quite a number of speeches delivered by members of the America First Committee, Congressman Colonel Lindbergh, General Wood, Father Coughlin. I helped out with speech writing, and I was vitally interested in keeping the United States out of World War II, and thereby incurred the wrath of President Roosevelt.
But they had to try it again during World War II, when we see our government use sedition against pamphleteers. The same people, those same advocates of strong central government, were again the perpetrators. The same one-worlders were pushing the government to try individuals on sedition charges, just like in the days of Jefferson. Mm-hmm. Why were they so opposed to your literature?
Mm-hmm. Because it attacked the administration. Because it criticized Roosevelt for dragging the United States into a war that 85% of the people had indicated they were against. Because many of us, not all of us, but many of us have been in the habit of exposing what I term the synagogue of Satan.
In the World War II sedition trial, the power behind the government forced the indictment of those men and women who opposed the United States entering the war against Germany.
Many argue we're using it as a way of shutting down and eliminating from the public scene the America Firsters, the Bundists, and all the people that have had opposed the New Deal and the Roosevelt administration and its prosecution of the war.
Lenin, who was a spokesman for the Zionist communist cause, stated that the road to total world control was through Germany, and therefore Germany had to be destroyed. I found it interesting that during this period of time, the enemies of the government were marked with such titles as Nazis and fascists. While during the trial in Fort Smith, Arkansas in 1988, the pet names for such enemies were white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and racists. Mm. Are you a neo-Nazi?
You know, when they first started calling us that in the media, I had to ask somebody what it meant. I had no idea what it meant.
Guitarist says, I had no idea what the fuck that is, dude. I'm not surprised. It's a made-up concept. It's ridiculous. You know, for them to say, you know, if they had just said Nazi, maybe that would make more sense, I guess. But I really don't understand the neo part. Like, that's the part I don't get. Like, what's new about it? Like if the Democrat Party was destroyed today, gone, right? War happens, Democrats are in power, they're running the country, maybe they're doing good, or vice versa, Republicans for that matter, it doesn't matter, pick one. They're running the country, war happens, it kicks off, America's destroyed, we lose. Boom, boom, city's gone, boom, everybody's, chaos, destruction. Years go by, and people started looking to what these Democrats thought, and they're like, maybe they had something right there. Would you call them neo-Democrats? Or would you just call them Democrats? I don't know. I guess it makes a sort of a sense, but it's just a weird... It sounds like the term Nazi wasn't scary enough at some point. It's kind of funny, because that's why it was, you know, derived in the first place. You know, National Socialist doesn't sound very scary. You know, doesn't sound particularly frightening. So, it was Conrad Haydn. He had to come up with the term Nazi. Ignatz. Is like hillbilly, I guess. Country bumpkin, hillbilly, ignoramus. In and of itself, it's an insult word. In and of itself, it's a pejorative. So the neo just sounds like they're trying to double it up, you know? They're trying to double dose it, right? Yeah, you call them neo shitlibs, right? Right, exactly. Exactly. Would we walk around calling them neo shitlibs? Or would we just call them shitlibs? They were saying neo-Nazis in the 40s. No, I don't think so. No, they were saying in the 80s, though, for sure. This is 88. By the 80s, they were using that pretty hard. I don't know when they started using it. You know what? Let's find out. I think I can find that out. You want to know how? Magic. Dreamer magic. Let's find out some streamer magic. You guys want to find out? Let's find out. We don't have to go back to 1800, so I'm going to look a little closer than that. I'm just going to start from 45. Well, no, I'll start before the war's over. Let's say 33 to present. Oh, they'll only let me search it. Okay. Now let's try this. Aha. Well, look at that. It's barely in use in the 80s, and it's really about 1989 that the climb starts, but it's 1990, and then it's gadoof, this motherfucker goes up and up. Just do this. Wait a minute. Hey, you know, Google is good for something. This is the... Wait, can I zoom that out? I hope I can zoom that out. Oh, it's really not going to let me zoom that shit out? Seriously, bro? Seriously? All right. Fuck you then. All right, let me see if I can do it. Maybe this way will work. Aha. Kind of. Yeah, I mean, sort of. It just, the crop is awful. Yeah, all right. Well, that's kind of, you can see, right? So, okay, good enough. So, in the, like, look at this. In the 70s, it's in the 60s and 70s, it's non-existent. It's non-existent. So in Rockwell's era, so Rockwell's dead in 67, I believe, right? I think it's 67. It's not 63. It's 67. Yeah. Or is it 69? No, I think it's 67. Yeah, okay. So Rockwell's doing his thing. It's not even being used. It's not even being used. Nobody's, in other words, nobody was calling Rockwell a neo-Nazi. They were just calling him a Nazi. Right? So, and that's about as, like, post-National Socialist Germany Nazi as you can get, right? I mean, it's, I can't even think of a better example, right? But the interesting thing, it doesn't really become a thing until 1990 about. And then you can see, like, between 1990 and 2000, the steep incline, and following that, it just keeps climbing every year. Every year, and it's just going up and up and up. So this is based on how much this is published in a book. Smoothness. Zero. Oh, okay. You take off the smoothing. Okay, look at that. So just see the trend without the smoothing. But I mean, you can look. It's just not being done here. In 1977, it's literally 0%. 0%. 0%. 0%. Oh, and there it kicks in. What's that? There's a little touch of it. There's a little touch of it in 78. There's something that happens there. There's something in 68. They're trying to make it be a thing as well. It's like woke right, right? Like they're trying to make it be a thing in 1968. That's probably Rockwell kind of stuff, right? There's a little touch of it in 53, but it just goes away. Little tiny splattering of it in 60, early 60s. Comes back again in Rockwell's era, but barely. Just barely. Going along, and there's little tiny bumps where it's like a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a percent. But it's not until almost 1990 that it actually becomes used. And then you can see it's like by the mid-90s, that shit's going up. And then down again. And up more and up more. So really starting in 1997. From 1997 to present, it's pretty much only gone up with a couple little tiny dips. I mean, there's a massive spike. So between 2006 and 2010, massive spike. And it drops down from 2010 to 2012, or 2010 to 2012. Okay, right. So from 2012, another massive spike, and a little roller coaster ride all the way up to 2016. So this is the Obama to Trump era there. And then it drops a little bit down shortly after Trump gets in, and then, whoa, it's all the way up to the Charlottesville era. And then down again it goes. But it's only gone up between 1997 and 2019. It's been on a steep incline ever since. But to me, the interesting thing is I expected it to be earlier than this. I expected it to be in use by late 70s. That's where I would have put it. I would have guessed that it began. Became a starting thing in the late 70s. And you can see a minute, tiny fraction. But it's not significant. It's not until the 90s, really. Late 80s, early 90s. Really the 90s. I mean, it's basically, look at that, it's about 1990 is where it starts. And it's not really until about 1994 that the incline starts. And then it just starts and goes. In 1997, it's at a dip, but it starts from there. It goes only up after 1997. That's very weird. Let's just try the word "just Nazi." Oh, look at that spike in 1940. It's like a kind of the opposite, really. You see, it actually kind of dropped down in a way because they just swapped it out for neo-Nazi at this point. Oh no! Hey, no, that's not do. What we're trying to do here. That's crazy. So even in the 30s, it starts building in 36. It seems like they really coin it in 33. Probably before that, though. I started at a 33. Let me put it in. Let's put 20. Let's put 23 just for good measure. Okay, so it really, the word Nazi is coined in about 1930, 1929. And there's a huge spike up from there up until 33. And then it dips down a little bit. And between 36 and 41, there's nothing but a straight up incline. And there's a massive drop down after that into the 50s. And it's around, but it's kind of tapering out and sort of flattening out. That's interesting. That's a very interesting assessment. I wouldn't have guessed that. Yeah. Ignaz or Ignazi is a German ethnic slur, means hick or hayseed. The Jewish Menace promoted its use. Yeah, they did. Share the link, support the show.
Do you know what it means now?
It means new Nazi, a new member of the German Workers' Party that ceased to exist in 1945, I guess. I have today taken it to mean that anybody who believes in the identity of faith is now classified as a neo-Nazi. And if that's what it is, if being a neo-Nazi is believing in the identity of faith, then yes, I'm a neo-Nazi. But am I a Hollywood stereotype Nazi? No, ma'am. No way, shape, or form. Okay.
I was already captured before I even understood what the terminology neo-Nazi meant. I didn't even know what it meant when I read it in the newspaper until someone explained it to me.
Where do you think?
So no, it's not true.
Where do you think the term came from?
I think it's a media catchword, one to elicit emotion, to put a title on us that everyone can identify with by using new Nazi. They identify with the old Nazis. And so this is just one to elicit anger and hatred, so forth.
Yep. President Roosevelt and the New Deal administration, operating through the Department of Justice, caused 28 American men and women residing in different parts of this country to be indicted, arrested, and taken from their homes to Washington, D.C. for trial in a foreign jurisdiction. Entrapment schemes were used in setting the stage at the nation's capital. This was accomplished by having Dillard Stokes, a reporter on the Washington Post, addressed letters to the victims under the alias of Jefferson Breen and Quigley Adams, in which he ordered copies of their books, pamphlets, newspapers, and magazines mailed into the District of Columbia. Those victims marked for destruction found themselves in a hostile atmosphere where no one could expect to locate jurors who were not in some way, directly or indirectly, obligated to the federal government.
The government prosecutor later turned out to be a member of the Communist Party and one of Joseph Stalin's five best friends. His name was Rodion Rogge. He was a lawyer later on too for the Rosenbergs, and they were tried for delivering our atomic secrets to the Soviet Union.
Trial lasted for over 4 years, with Judge Eicher presiding over the case. Just before the case was thrown out of court, Judge Eicher died in his sleep, and another observing judge, Honorable Chief Justice Bolivia J. Laws, declared it to be a travesty upon justice.
The judge said, that is a travesty upon justice. He said, every one of these defendants are victims of a travesty upon justice. He said, the case is dismissed against all of them. Case dismissed. That's the way I wound up. But it had ruined most of us financially. So the government can afford to try you, whether they have any evidence or not. They can ruin you financially and use you to frighten anyone else that might be tempted to resist them.
Among the defendants were several members of the Nazi German American Bunds. Just as the order members during the Fort Smith trial, these men in general had already been convicted of other crimes and were serving many years in prison already.
They really did some hanky-panky with respect to
grouping together men like, say, from the German-American Boone during World War II, who had already been convicted of other crimes and put into prison. And they then lumped together with them Christian ministers such as Gerald Winrod, Elizabeth Dilling, who was a marvelous Christian lady who wrote the book, The Plot Against Christianity. And in all probability, that was the reason she was there as a defendant in the trial.
A few of the charges that the government made in the 24-point indictment include the following statements that the defendants were reported to have said or written.
The government of the United States, the Congress, and public officials are controlled by communists, international Jews, and plutocrats. The present war is a dishonest war waged at the expense and measured in the blood and dollars of the people of the United States solely for the benefit of and to ensure the continuance of world domination by international bankers, international capitalists, Mongolian Jews, communists, and international Jewry. An honorable and just peace could be brought about speedily were it not for the opposition of the communists, international Jewry, and war profiteers.
Now, these proceedings did not pass without public and legislative protest. Senator Robert Taft of Ohio gave a lengthy castigation of the government's attempt to convict these men and women. Committees were organized and operated on a national scale, which were made up of pastors and laymen opposing these convictions. They realized that the government wanted to browbeat into silence every man and woman of God who might dare to lift a voice against strong central government and communism. There were even riots in the Rocky Mountain area over this trial. Senator Taft was quoted as saying,
"I am deeply alarmed by the growing tendency to smear loyal citizens who are critical of the national administration and the conduct of the war. Something very close to fanaticism exists in certain circles here. I cannot understand it, I cannot grasp it, but I am sure of this. Freedom of speech itself is at stake unless the general methods pursued by the Department of Justice are changed. What would you say if, out of a clear sky, someone asked you if the sons of the American Revolution were disloyal? If the descendants of the sons of the signers of the Declaration of Independence and the General Society of the Mayflower descendants and the ladies of the Grand Army of the Republic had permitted themselves to be used to corrupt the American Army? Absurd, ridiculous, impossible, of course. Absurd, yes. Yet that is precisely the charge which the Department of Justice has brought against those societies by indirection and inference in an indictment on file in the District of Columbia."
Congressman John T. Rankin inserted the entire indictment into the congressional record and made this statement to the House.
"Mr. Speaker, I hesitate to use the word Jew in any speech in this House. For whenever I do, a little group of communist Jews howl to the high heaven. They seem to think that it's all right for them to abuse Gentiles and to stir up race troubles. But when you refer to one of them, they cry anti-Semitism or accuse you of being pro-Nazi."
Wow. Wow. Same pattern way back then. That is a long time ago, and they're still doing the exact same thing.
"Read this indictment and then read it again, and ask yourself if the white Gentiles of this country have no rights left that the Department of Justice is bound to respect."
I found it extremely interesting that while our government kept these 28 men and women on trial for 4 years, the war lasted for that length of time. Could it have been planned to keep these patriotic American writers, speech givers, and pamphleteers quiet until the war was completed? And now again, after 200 years and two tries, our government attempted for the third time in history to prosecute Americans for seditious conspiracy. The United States government claims some of the overt actions of the alleged conspiracy took place in the Western District of Arkansas. But most of the alleged actions of the alleged conspiracy took place far from Arkansas. I came to Fort Smith to report on the proceedings of this trial. I realized before coming the historical significance surrounding the trial, but never surmise the many underhanded tactics used by our government in order for them to shut up men and women whom they feel are in opposition to them. On the first day of the trial, February 16, 1988, 130 potential jurors were brought into courtroom 310. Out of these 130 potential jurors, 18 jurors would be chosen to sit in possibly one of the longest trials in the history of this nation. I was amazed that within 8 hours, the 18 jurors were chosen. Is selecting a jury in one day for such a complicated case unusual?
For this case, I think it's appalling. Now, the judge, I will say this, the judge was trying to be fair. I think in his mind, he thought he was being fair. And in his mind, he thought this is the best way to pick a jury and not to pre-prejudice them with a lot of other questions. But my own personal feeling, I was appalled at how quickly it was done and the fact that we had no opportunity to get to know this jury at all.
Not only would these 18 men and women decide the fate of 14 men, but their decision would make a difference, possibly forever, in the lives of every American who loves and cherishes their freedom of speech and freedom to worship as they choose. I doubted anyone's ability to keep facts straight for over 2 months of very controversial testimony.
I don't think it's possible for humankind to keep all of this thing straightened out as to each defendant.
I was not only disappointed, but also astounded to learn that many of the witnesses our government was using against the 14 defendants had very little credibility in the eyes of the public. Would our government rationalize lying, cheating, or whatever in order to obtain a guilty verdict on these men?
Well, in their own minds, they rationalize this.
They rationalize lying,
well,
cheating, and buying
well,
people
if,
off?
You know, and of course, you know, this is very early in the trial, and it would be improper for me to comment that, and say outright that all the government's witnesses are going to lie. Even if you take that argument, let's just assume for a minute they are lying, they have rationalized from a very mainstream American point of view that these men are dangerous, and these men need to be put away.
This is one of the things that just does not really make any sense to us, that our government, that it belongs to us, would resort to these type of things.
I express my contempt to the judge about the government using witnesses who lie. Mm-hmm. And the judge agreed with me. He said, "But Mr. Pierce, this is an issue for the jury to decide."
James Ellison, who called himself the King of the Ozarks, and claimed another man spiritually dead so he could have the man's wife, was the state's key witness against most of the defendants.
Wow.
Ellison claimed Richard Butler, along with several others, entered into a conspiracy with him at Pastor Butler's Aryan Nations Congress held in Hayden Lake, Idaho, at their mountainous family campground in 1983. Ellison claims he passed around a piece of paper where each man present signed it, and then Ellison stated they had just committed treason against the United States of America.
Well, I think the piece of paper was passed around and everybody signed it, put their name and address on it, but I believe it was the sheer mailing list.
Of James Ellison.
Well, James Ellison had a publication he sent out.
Right.
Okay, and these other people put out publications, so they wanted to swap publications back and forth. That's all I believe it was for.
Although this piece of paper was never presented as evidence in court, this one man's testimony, according to the government, outweighed all the other men's in the alleged conspiracy that night. According to the government, by these men's silence at Ellison's comment, they were guilty of sedition. How can you conspire to overthrow the government with someone you have barely met?
Ellison, I've seen him twice. This is the third time I've seen him today.
He was not a friend as such.
Oh, no.
In 1983, Gordon Call and Sheriff Gene Matthews were allegedly murdered by the FBI in a house owned by Bill Wade of Smithville, Arkansas. After much investigation
Burned
into these
alive.
Murders, Mr. Wade and his son Ray formed a citizens' committee to beseech the courts for a federal grand jury investigation into these murders. They also had filed lawsuits against the FBI and other government agencies. Again, the key witness who testified against not only Bill and Ray Wade, but also David McGuire, son-in-law of James Ellison, and Lambert Miller, was the king of the Ozarks himself, James Ellison.
In fact, all the witnesses against us have criminal records, extreme criminal records, and there's no evidence that we did anything, and it's just the testimony of convicted felons. That's all it is. And we both flatly denied having any knowledge or participation or even talking to those people during that period of time. And we say it's a complete invention and fabrication, total.
Mr. Ellison testified that Bill and Ray Wade met with him in an old abandoned feed mill and offered money to Ellison and any one of his followers who would murder Federal Judge Waters and FBI agent Jack Knox. In the prosecution's closing arguments, Mr. Snyder argued that Ray and Bill Wade had an absolute obsession with these murders and would do anything they could to get even. As I became better acquainted with these
can't conspire without planning, lol, what bullshit. Yeah, well, exactly, Bill. A lot of these people had never even met each other. It's not that they had met each other. No, they hadn't. They had barely met each other. A lot of these people had met each other like three times. And, you know, there's a part in this when Richard Butler is like, yeah, I met this guy like twice, and this is the third time at the trial. So they're trying to get the jury to believe that this guy that he's met twice, he's having this like plot to overthrow the government with. It's absurd. And it's obviously just a different kind of witch hunt. This is obviously a mechanism for the government to try to shut down this. This is part of their overall Patriot conspiracy operation, PatCon. Right? They had this whole FBI program in the 80s to get this sealed up. And this was all part of something called Operation Clean Sweep. Now, one of the funny things about that is the feds and the authorities, they so frequently use this title, Operation Clean Sweep, that you can find, like, even if you put an Operation Clean Sweep 1988 into YouTube, you will get, like, literally, like, crack cocaine bust operations in California. Like it's just some kind of generalized title, I guess, that they use for so many of these operations. But this was part of an operation to try to just shut all this down, to just put the hammer down on the far right, I guess, as they were calling them at this time. Shut it all down. Shut it down. These are Goyim who know. We can't have it. Cannot have it. Odyssey is glitchy tonight. Well, what else is new, right? It's a good night to try. Well, Rumble works, I guess, but Rumble is actually still the highest quality version of this stream just because it's where that's possible. Still a good night to try out White Pilled or FDJ as well.
Two men who, by the way, are being labeled as white supremacists by the media when, in fact, they are Choctaw Indians. Huh. I did not see obsession, but rather a burning desire.
Who's Choctaw that they're calling white supremacist?
Ellison. I've seen him twice. This is the third time I've seen him today.
He was not a friend, yep, as such. Oh, no. In 1983, Gordon Call and Sheriff Gene Matthews were allegedly murdered by the FBI in a house owned by Bill Wade of Smithville, Arkansas. Bill and Ray Wade met with him in an old abandoned feed mill and offered money to Ellison and any one of his followers who would murder Federal Judge Waters and FBI agent Jack Knox. In the prosecution's closing arguments, Mr. Snyder argued that Ray and Bill Wade had an absolute obsession with these murders and would do anything they could to get even. As I became better acquainted with these two men, who, by the way, are being labeled as white supremacists by the media when, in fact, they are Choctaw Indians,
Knox.
I did not see obsession, but rather a burning desire to see justice done in these unsolved murders.
I've said open publicly on television that I knew no other reason that I could be targeted for government prosecution other than that I had become a thorn in their side and a voice crying out for justice in that particular instance. I'd asked for grand juries. I'd gone on television, radios, things like this, speaking out against the events that happened on June the 3rd, 1983. And, of course, as such, why we're still trying to find avenues and means to have this investigated and, of course, to get some justice put to the issue.
James Ellison is presently incarcerated by our government for charges of possession of illegal firearms. By his own testimony, he has not only received witness immunity, but his two wives and 12 children are presently being cared for with American taxpayers' money and are also under government protection.
Let me make a note of that. Seven. I want to note the time because I want to jump ahead for a minute here. So one of the things that got them interested in the CSA is they found a big stash there. They had quite a stash. Let's jump ahead to this, then we'll jump back. So this is going to kind of characterize better what got them started in this whole hunt, I guess, in the first place. On the starting point. On here. Yeah, there it is. I think that's it. Oh, not quite. Almost. Now, this is pulled from a Tim McVeigh documentary. Because, as Frank said when he came on here one time, that all these events are not separate. These are not separate. These are like different chapters of the same book. Like all of these different events, everything from Ruby Ridge to Waco, Oklahoma City, that these are all tied up together in one big story. Well, chapters of a different chapters of the same story. I tend to subscribe to the possibility that to the theory, I guess, that there is a high possibility that the Oklahoma City thing was not what we're told it is, and that there might have been, let's just say, some government fingerprints on the whole thing, because it was the ultimate nail in the coffin to seal this up. Up until that point, the militias were growing everywhere quite rapidly. This goes off Oklahoma City, and then following that, the attendance and membership in militias just plummets to almost nothing. So you have to also suspect, along with all the other evidence, there's a lot of evidence that there's something wrong with that story. But along with all the other evidence, you have to suspect that maybe this was kind of a coup de grace on the militia movement, a way to just take it out of action. Let me sort of find the actual starting point here somewhere. I didn't upload the whole damn thing, did I? Yeah, okay, here it is. I put more on there than I needed to. Yeah, there it is. Okay, there's the start. Operation Clean Sweep, baby.
In the 1980s, the entire brunt of the United States government was turned on the right wing, and they tried to put it out of business, just like the government tried to do that same thing to the so-called Reds in the 1950s.
Thus began Operation Clean Sweep, a huge government offensive against far-right groups across the country. To initiate it, on April 19, 1985, a date revered by the far-right as Patriots Day, federal agents surround the CSA compound to indict the leaders on federal charges of manufacturing and possessing illegal firearms. When a standoff results, officials contact one of CSA's closest allies, Robert Millar, a Canadian-born Mennonite preacher who presides over his own religious compound, Elohim City, in the backwoods of the Ozarks near Muldrow, Oklahoma.
I was contacted by the FBI right here, and they asked me if I would be interested in preventing bloodshed. And I said, of course. And so they said, well, all of the men there were prepared to resist and to die. And the leader says he doesn't trust anybody except Robert G. Millar. That's my name. So they flew me up there, and there was sort of a no man's land.
On the third day of the standoff, Millar persuades CSA to give up and lay down their arms. When they finally enter the compound, authorities are astounded by what they find.
As far as I know, this is the largest confiscation of weapons and explosives probably in the history of the FBI and the ATF.
Operation Clean Sweep continues, producing indictments against leaders of radical groups around the country. The charges include robbery, counterfeiting, assassination, and bombing, all with the goal of provoking and financing a revolution against the government.
These groups were characterized by an anti-government feeling. Now, there's a lot of folks that don't like the federal government, so that doesn't make it unlawful.
Wild to see that Asa Hutchinson was still in office in 1988.
But they took this to the extreme of carrying out acts to further their purpose. The movement should realize that there's an extreme price to be paid for violent and unlawful activity.
What the government was preparing for was a sedition trial to try to prove a conspiracy between major players in the right-wing movement to overthrow the United States government. You had, I believe it was 14 defendants altogether on the sedition trial.
As the sedition trial begins in 1988 in Fort Smith, Arkansas, the scene outside looks like a convocation of right-wing extremists. During the trial, Kerry Noble and other members of CSA turn state's evidence, exposing...
there you go. It turned state's evidence. There you go. Dirty, dirty.
Richard Wayne Snell's original 1983 plot to blow up the Murrah Federal Building.
Wayne Snell had made a trip to Oklahoma City, and Wayne came back and told me about different buildings that he had seen, wanted to know if I would look at them with him sometime, and asked me to design a rocket launcher that could be used to destroy these buildings from a distance, fortified or heavy, large buildings.
Despite the testimonies, the jury fails to accept their credibility. After 7 weeks, the defendants are cleared of all charges against them.
The whole ordeal of the trial sucked the energies out of the far-right leadership, but the government fell miserably on its face and lost. And it was in the aftermath of that loss that the far-right really kind of reorganized and reappeared in the most devastating manner in Oklahoma City.
Cleared along with the others.
That's why I suspect it's not legit. Plus, I mean, there's a lot of other more specific evidence. I'll have to see if I can find that. I mean, there's really one that just does it really well in like 5 minutes. Yep, there it is. I think this is it. Something seriously wrong with this whole story. There's one by Corbett Report. I think this is a different one that I just found, though. But it says everything. Yeah, that's... Oh, it's the same one. Yeah. It's really sus. Like, there's a whole bunch of... information that just doesn't fit at all with their official story, including just the idea of the bomb itself. Like, you would have to have a bomb inside the building to do that kind of damage. Having a bomb outside just kind of doesn't make sense.
Are you the Oklahoma City bomber?
Maybe one of the benefits of me talking to you today is that you'll see that maybe not everything is true that you've heard about me.
On the morning of April 19, 1995, a decorated Gulf War combat vet blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City using a truck bomb that he didn't build and a Ryder truck that he didn't rent with the help of a passenger who didn't exist. Having just gotten away with the largest act of terrorism on U.S. soil to date, the Fort Bragg-trained Special Forces Sheep Drip dropout blended in with the crowd by making his getaway in a car without a license plate and was immediately pulled over. The ATF was the supposed target of the attack, but luckily all of their agents were out of the office that morning. Later that day, the president boldly declared,
"We will find the people who did this."
And
when we do, justice will be swift, certain, and severe.
Except for
John Doe number two.
John Doe number two.
John Doe number two.
Who, according to the FBI, never existed. In McVeigh's unprecedented 3.5-week trial, the prosecution didn't show the CCTV footage of him and John Doe number two parking the Ryder truck. Didn't explain why 24 separate witnesses mass hallucinated the existence of John Doe number two. Didn't explain why the government was testing truck bombs and the Army was storing Ryder trucks at Camp Gruber right before the bombing, and didn't talk to the FBI informants who blew the whistle on the plot. But they did collaborate with the CIA, and they did convict McVeigh as the lone wolf bomber and Terry Nichols as his bomb-constructing accomplice. Still, a bunch of crazy conspiracy theorists, including 300 bombing victims, insist on talking about facts and evidence and refuse to simply believe what they've been told a million times by people in tailored suits with well-coiffed hair. They quote the U.S. Army Brigadier General and the FBI Crime Lab whistleblower and the inventor of the neutron bomb who point out the physical impossibility that the Ryder truck bomb did the damage to the building, but that doesn't matter because if there were other bombs in the building that day, we would have heard about them.
The second explosive was found and defused.
I think he said another bomb.
The Justice Department is reporting that a second explosive device has been found.
They then found a third device, which was also larger than the first.
And I see another bomb truck going, so apparently they're going to try to get out that third bomb.
The FBI claims to have lost the footage showing McVeigh and John Doe number two parking the truck in front of the Murrah building that morning, but that's understandable because the Bureau has a lot of important evidence to store. Terry Nichols insists the FBI was involved in the plot, but thankfully a judge has saved us the trouble of listening to him by preventing lawyers from deposing him. There was a bomb squad truck parked across the street 2 hours before the blast, but that just shows the authorities were prepared for anything. And
they're so smart.
Other documents obtained by 2020 show that someone called the executive secretariat's office at the Justice Department in Washington and said the Murrah building had been bombed. But this was 24 minutes before the blast.
But that just shows the public was unusually vigilant that morning. Also,
apparently, before the bombing, Governor Frank Keating's brother, Mark, had been working on a novel about a terrorist bombing in Oklahoma City. Stranger still, one of the characters in the novel was named Thomas McVeigh.
But that's probably just a coincidence. McVeigh wrote a letter to his sister where he admitted to being a secret special forces operative and he complained to friends of the pain in his ass from an army-implanted microchip. But that's crazy, because if he didn't actually leave the army in 1991, there would be proof of that. McVeigh was not executed on May 16, 2001 as scheduled because
the FBI had failed to turn over thousands of pages of evidence to McVeigh's defense attorneys.
But the execution went ahead on June 11th. In a highly unusual and secret agreement, no autopsy was performed. One witness said he was still breathing, and the prison officials admitted his hearse was a decoy. Then, the case...
That's the thing, right? Like, they could say that they executed anybody, and how the hell are you going to prove that they actually did or didn't? Like, there's no way to prove that. You'd either take their word for it or not.
This was officially closed. And if you question any part of this story, you are a paranoid, wingnut, birther, truther, tenther, prepper, conspiracy loon who'd bring up any of these points ever again. Ever. This message has been brought to you by the friends of the FBI, ATF, DOJ, CIA, SPLC, MSM, and the U.S. Army. And remember, ignorance is strength.
That's a good little quick rundown of some of the things that are wrong with this. There's a lot that are wrong with this official story that don't add up. Especially this thing to me. This is whack. Like the idea that you're going to be able to blow through this massive concrete structure. Well, I guess concrete and steel structure. With a bomb outside of the building. It's like this, right? If you have a firecracker, you put the firecracker in the palm of your hand and you light it and it goes off, right? It's going to burn your hand a little bit, for sure. It's going to hurt. But if you put that same firecracker in your palm and light that fucker and hold it until it explodes, you're going to be a handless motherfucker, okay? So there is a thing about containing the force and having the force released to do destruction versus having the destructive force, the exploding force, happen on the outside of something. Right, Because then the force will dissipate into the open space. It's going to, the force will take the path of the least resistance. If it's contained within something, it's going to destroy the structure it's contained within. So that's a big problem in the story for sure. And that's same goes for 9/11 too.
Richard Twin Wayne Towers Snell anyway. Returns to prison on his earlier murder convictions. By this time, some of the members of the CSA have left the Arkansas compound and moved to Elohim City in Oklahoma. Here, their resentment of the government will continue under the sympathetic eyes of Pastor Robert Millar.
Elohim! All right, wait a minute. Let's go back to what we were doing here. So that's, we jump way to the end. So where was he? Where was we? Let me get back there. Ant. 45. Out there.
Nazi obsession, but rather a burning desire to see justice done in these unsolved murders.
I've said open publicly on television that I knew no other reason that I could be targeted for government prosecution other than that I had become a thorn in their side and a voice crying out for justice in that particular instance. I'd asked for grand juries. I'd gone on television, radios, things like this, speaking out against the events that happened on June the 3rd, 1983. And, of course, as such, why we're still trying to find avenues and means to have this investigated and, of course, to get some justice put to the issue.
James Ellison is presently incarcerated by our government for charges of possession of illegal firearms. By his own testimony, he has not only received witness immunity, but his two wives and 12 children are presently being cared for with American taxpayers' money and are also under government protection. Mm-hmm. Allegations have been made that Mr. Ellison is receiving a shortened sentence because of his cooperation in this trial. And if our government had succeeded in obtaining a guilty conviction on these men, he would have been released from prison. And much of the testimony against many of the defendants was produced by Robert Matthews, a dead man. Many witnesses claimed Robert Matthews admitted to certain crimes and implicated many of the Fort Smith defendants in his statements.
A dead man did the testifying so much it is unbelievable. Under common law, a dead man's not allowed to testify. Right.
After sitting through several weeks of this trial, I had to ask myself, why is the government so persistent on getting a guilty verdict on these men? Why were they willing to spend well over $8 million of our taxpayers' money, paying out $6,000 a day for the court-appointed attorneys alone, and have spent 3 years of much tedious research? What potential danger do these men and their ideas pose to the security of this present form of government?
I don't believe that we should have a de facto government. There's a great difference between a de jure government and a de facto government. I've written about that, and that's one of the reasons I'm probably in court. And I put out newsletters on the de facto government of the United States. And while I can't refute anything I've said, because I have all the facts, they can bring me into court or charge me.
Not only do I have enmity. I hate this government because it sets itself up in a position that's God's position to make and regulate laws, many of which are contrary to what is best for my people, my race, Israel. How can I feel otherwise?
They're all dedicated men with individual beliefs, individual concepts, who have been willing to lay it all on the line for their own race and their own God as they see them.
Why would they want to send someone such as yourself?
Joseph is right. He said the trial was was conducted as a chilling notice to anyone else who would dare defy the government. Yeah, they do a lot of stuff like that. That's a common tactic they use. They love to make examples out of people. It's one of their favorite things to do. They love to make examples out of people. It's just something they're into. It's kind of the hallmark of a corrupt regime. They can't deal with the issues of their people directly. when their people start to complain about these issues, instead of trying to address any of the issues, they just attack the people or silence them.
Well, the only major crime was to be behind the wheel in a vehicle in an armed car robbery and give you six times greater sentencing than anyone else. What is it they don't like about Richard Scutari?
My beliefs and the fact that I won't bow down to him. My knee only bends to my God and won't bend to these people. I don't care what they do to me.
And you think they realize this?
Oh, they know it.
I have shown during the...
Yeah, that's true. James Fields is a recent example of this. Yeah. Oh, yeah, completely. Completely. And it's sick because when you know the real story there, I mean, I'm not going to say that he should have done it or whatever, but he wasn't doing it for the reasons they said he did it. He was doing it to flee the communist with the rifle pointed at him, which makes way more sense than like he was just like in a rage to kill nons or whatever. Like the idea that somebody goes down there and is like, I know, I'll throw my whole life away and kill some nons. I don't know, dude. Like, people that are going to do that shit in general, most people who are going to do that shit, they're just going to go rampage off on some nons or something. And I include Jews and nons. When they do that, they know that they're done. You're cooked. I mean, you're either dead or in prison, and you have to know that. I mean, you would have to be dumber than room temperature IQ not to know that, because it's obvious what's going to happen there. You're either going to die in the fight with the authorities, or you're going to go to prison forever. You're not going to escape that kind of a thing. I don't think anybody who does that, if they're not like literally almost retarded, is going to think that they're going to do something like that and run away and get away with it. So usually it's like this, I guess almost like a suicidal thing, where they know they're done. They know they're cooked. That once they do it, that's the end. It's like a final hurrah, you know. But I don't think that you would do it in that way. I don't suspect you would. I think if he was going to do that, it just doesn't make sense, you know? There's a lot of things about it where it's just the motive doesn't sort of match what actually happened. And so, of course, you had that lesbian Jewish woman, I forget what her name is at the moment, but she was kind of like the one that spearheaded the Charlottesville stuff. And they were just looking for a way to pin this on everybody. And I think that the James Fields thing, by making him into a murderer instead of somebody that was running from armed commies, it made it so that the entire event was murderous in its nature. That there was this murderous intent behind the whole event. And of course, she starts digging up all this nasty, like, you know, just usually these offhanded edgelord comments in chats and whatever. And she's digging up, you know, Discord chats and shit. Oh, they're making jokes about running people over here. And that was common at the time. Like, that's the problem is, what they do is, in order to make this stuff seem more villainous than it is, they strip away all the context. They just, anybody that's doing that, by the way, I don't care who they are. If you see somebody doing that, trying to strip away the context from something, to villainize somebody, just throw out everything those people have to say. I don't care if they're, you know, Kaplan, Roberta Kaplan Jews like that, or if they have a siege mask on, whatever their fucking aesthetics and claims are. If that's what they're going to do, if they're going to remove the context from what people are saying to make it sound worse or to make it sound different from what it actually means or to reinterpret it to mean something else, that's a bad actor. And they don't have anything useful to add. So instead, what they do is they just subtract the context, which is required for truth, and they insert an implied context that often isn't even there. You know. So for example, in the Fields thing, right, they dug up all these Discord chats, which largely was just like our guys being edgelords with each other in private. And, you know, they had some jokes about running people over or whatever. What the context that's stripped away, though, is critical, right? The context is that in that time, there was BLM riot type things going on. And the joke was, just run them down. And this was a joke that was made not by, like, racialists. This was a joke that was made by, like, MAGA boomers. Like, this was a very common joke. This was a common joke you'd see on, like, Facebook. It was not edgelord shit that you could only find on the, you know, the white nationalist blog somewhere. It was fucking mainstream shit, or at least happened in mainstream venues. So for them to pretend like this somehow indicates a premeditation on his part it's just dishonesty. It's complete fucking dishonesty, which you'll notice doesn't bother them at all. Dishonesty is perfectly okay with them because they're just bad people with bad intentions.
Proceedings of the trial, there were many questionable facets surrounding the government's involvement. These questions were not only being asked in my own mind, but also in the minds of many of the defense attorneys and visiting public.
After handling this case, what do you think of the integrity of the government?
I think like most of the other attorneys in the case, I'm quite concerned with a lot of the testimony that I saw. I think a lot of the testimony was false that was presented by the government. And I also believe or think that the attorneys or the government's witnesses were were not credible at all. People like James Ellison, his story has changed so many times in the last few years, and that I just can't see him being credible at all.
So in the case of Ellison, I get the distinct impression that his whole motive was just to save his own ass. His whole thing was that if he sold out everybody else, his ass could be saved. And this is common in these things. It's a lot more common than you might even think. You know, it's easy to talk tough when people are like, oh, I would never do that. And hopefully you wouldn't. But, you know, at the same time, you got to think, like, it's very easy to say that stuff when you're free. But a lot of people, you know, when the pressure gets on, they cave and they get offered deals and stuff like this. So that's another reason why, like, it's probably not great to be getting involved in criminal shit, conspiracies, because the people you would be conspiring with, hopefully you're not, but the people you would be conspiring with, they're not as loyal as they want you to think they are. And it's a lot easier for them to flip than you might think.
How do you feel about the integrity of the government?
My ideas about the FBI changed pretty seriously.
Would you like to elaborate on that at all?
I've been very disappointed in what I've seen. That's about all I'll say on that fact.
When we tried to get interviews with the government's prosecutors concerning the many discrepancies surrounding this trial, they refused to talk with us. Those who were familiar with this trial believed that what was on trial was our First Amendment right, the right of free speech. Many others were saying that not only was our right of free speech on trial, but our freedom of religion was also on trial.
I believe the First Amendment is on trial, Ted. It's the right of the people to speak. That's what's on trial here.
I think basically the right-wing movement's on trial in this case. And it's just my own personal opinion that I think that the government has decided that these guys are getting too outspoken and it's time to shut them down and to destroy the movement. And that's basically my opinion on it.
Even though our federal government had over 110 witnesses for the state, some being directly involved with some of the 14 defendants, over 1,200 pieces of visual evidences, and actual proceedings lasting well over 8 weeks, the jury of 10 men and 2 women found these 14 defendants innocent on all charges.
Praise Yahweh for this miracle.
I don't have any regrets with any of the prosecution of any of the lawyers or anything that we did. It's just that we thought that we had presented the case in the best way that we could have.
Throughout the United States, there are over 150 other political prisoners being held by the federal government.
The matter was investigated by the FBI for some period of time. It was presented to us. We then presented it to several grand juries over an extended period of time. We thought that then the grand jury returned an indictment. We thought we had a good case.
The United States of America, once the greatest nation on earth, is being accused by many patriotic men and women across the land of allowing a despotic, tyrannical government to take over the governing system formed and set up by our founding fathers. And within this despotic government, they believe the ruling force has lost its sense of integrity and honor.
I think the most important thing that can come out of this trial is for the American public to understand that the government does not, and for a long time, has not worn a white hat.
What we have in this particular age is a government based on corruption. It's corrupt in the highest places. It's based its policies on hypocrisy. It's betrayed its own people. It's
so this man speaking, Robert Miles, he was instrumental in the creation of the concept of white nationalism, according to Frank. Frank said that he was one of the guys who was whose discussions about the topic and about the issues that the concepts intended to speak to, that he was critical in that. That doesn't surprise me. He was one of the guys who, I was trying to say it earlier, but I blanked on his name for a minute. He was one of the fellows where it was very hard to find stuff on him, but ultimately I did find enough to finally like piece together a WN Founders on him. But it was tough. It was not easy. He's one of these guys. So he has a like a lot of these guys, he does have a background in the OSS, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. A lot of these guys did. A lot of these guys did. Now the easy assumption there is to just be like, oh, gloaters. It's a lot more complicated than that. I think you have to think of it like a lot of these people were people that they were patriotic, so they joined up with these government programs in the first place. But as they got involved, they kind of found out that, wait a minute, that this is no longer a government of the people, by the people, for the people, that this is actually an occupied government. They didn't know that going in, and they're sort of like became dissenters from the inside when they found out. So there's a lot of that going on too, and it's easy to just kind of dismiss it all. I actually saw somebody, what's his name, Riley or something, say this, that, oh, well, like all these early guys were all glowies and feds and all this, and I don't remember what exact words he used, but he kind of implied it like that, and I think that's a very kind of simplistic way to look at it. And it's an assumption that, oh, well, just because, you know, there was some kind of connection there, that means that they're, you know, that the whole thing's an op, right? That all the early WN stuff is therefore an op. And I don't think that's at all the correct understanding.
It's not trusted by its own allies. It's the epitome of everything that is evil in government.
I found myself appalled at what our government had done in the lives of some of these defendants.
In October 9th, 1986, the FBI came to Memphis Federal Correction Institution, where I was originally housed. And they came and talked to me and ran down all their theory on this conspiracy and everything, and wanted me to cooperate and testify at a trial. And I told them I could not help them. And they said, well, go sleep on it, and we'll be back tomorrow and talk to you. Well, during this conversation, they laid down basically what come out in Fort Smith here. But when I come back the next day, they told me that they were going to see that Zilla served time. My brother would get another 20 years if I didn't cooperate.
Talk about a shakedown. Good Lord. I mean, imagine that. That's a hard position to be in, dude. That is a very difficult position to be in. I mean, when you're... I mean, he looks like he's in his mid-30s here. I mean, you're talking about the rest of your life, basically. He's on the chopping block of, like, you will work with us or we'll destroy you. It's like, oh, wow, okay then. Jeez. Evil. Fucking evil.
And then I told them then that you would not believe what I don't know. And I forget whether it was Jack Knox or Norm Stevens. One of the two says to me, well, that's all right. We'll supply you with names, dates, facts, and figures. I just looked at him and I smiled and I says, I can't lie for you people.
The first thing is I brought out in my cross-examination of Zilla Craig, did the government threaten to put you in jail and your children in foster homes if you did not cooperate? Yes.
That's the other angle they do. They threaten your children. They say, well, we're going to put your children in foster homes. What does that mean? What does that mean? They want, especially if you're a man like this, if you're a racialist, they want you to believe, and you know, there might not be an empty threat. They want you to believe that they're going to put your children in foster homes with blacks and whatever, like whatever it is that you don't want. And that's, they will. They do. It's really quite disturbing. Because it's another form of attack, right? It's to put you in a state of fear that your children are going to be abused because they put your, like, for example, they would put your children in with, I don't know, Tyrone and Shaniqua, and then they'll tell Tyrone and Shaniqua, hey, well, you got these little white kids that you're going to be your foster parents for, and by the way, their parents were some evil white supremos, so anyway, bye-bye, have fun. And that, you know, they assume or maybe even hope that therefore your children would be abused by Tyrone and Shaniqua under this pretext that you're an anti-black and your children have been handed over to blacks, right? So this is kind of the dirt that they do, and it's unfortunately it's not as uncommon as you might want it to be. Really a horrifying thought if you think about it, and that's why also when people do this thing, like you see this a lot. Or for status, people will say things like, oh, just have kids, bro, just have kids. Well, no, you have to have kids carefully. It's great. Yeah, having white children is fantastic, but you have to have them with the right woman or man. You're a woman. And if you're going to just have it haphazardly, like you're R-Select or something, well, don't be surprised when you have them with a psychotic woman and she, I don't know, gets pissed off at you or whatever and takes your kids away and fucks your life up in a big, big way. So I don't think that's smart. We should be encouraging our people to have kids, but intelligently, not like we're idiots and just like randomly, like we have no control over ourselves. It's not just a matter of producing white flesh. It's a matter of raising white children well to be good white people, white adults. If you just simply like let's just make white babies randomly, like, okay, well then you're just being like, you're just adopting the Negro and Hispanic, or I guess mestizo reproduction method. That's not good. We want to raise high quality white people. That's what set white people apart in the fucking first place, is that we actually invested in our children. Hey, Select, right? If we just abandon that just because we have this like freak out about our numbers, which it's a problem, don't get me wrong, big problem, but if we overreact in a sort of haphazard way, We might do more damage than good in that. It needs to be done carefully. And really, ultimately, if you really care about that, you sincerely care about that, and it's not just a ha-ha, one-up kind of bullshit over some other randos in chat, then you should be seeking to figure out ways to make actual communities in the physical world where single white men and women that are not married can meet each other and get married and then therefore have kids. That's the most productive way to actually work towards solving that issue. But pretending that, like, you know, you should just encourage white people to just start behaving like they're, you know, modic R-Select retards, that's not going to help shit. Like, let's not pretend that there aren't bad white people. Unfortunately, there are. We don't want to produce bad white people. We want to produce good white people. Productive, healthy, decent white people. Got to be done with intelligence. Can't just be like, I don't know, let's just have a mass white people fuck party. Like, that's not going to help shit. And it's not the success isn't having the child. The success is raising the child well. That's the challenge is. That's the difficulty is.
I asked Richard Scutari's wife, Michelle Scutari, the very same here, question. Pagamere, same here. Was yes. I asked my wife that, my ex-wife, mind you, and she said, answered yes. I think any government that goes to such low and underhanded methods is criminal in itself. To attack women and children, a threat.
After my many weeks of research, I had to ask myself the question, is there a power behind our American government? Are there really unseen forces behind the scenes?
Uh-oh.
Of course.
Gooden!
Definitely.
Okay, what?
I believe the ADL is pushing them into getting all these, quote, hate groups off the streets.
Mm-hmm. He's right. He's right. Let's not forget, of course, ADL and the FBI share the same building. They can literally walk down the hall and get on the elevator and go down and see their buddies. Like, that's fucking crazy, but it's also true. Please do support the show. Share the link.
Operation Clean Sweep, you know, that's been quoted in the ADL's vocabulary for quite some time now.
Many of those I interviewed are accusing the Zionist movement in America, Attorney General Meese, the Anti-Defamation League, and its alleged hatred towards right-wingers, Christians, and especially what some call the identity movement, mm-hmm. for being responsible for what they call Operation Clean Sweep.
I do believe that the government's intent was to shut down the right-wing movement. That was Attorney General Meese's opinion. We have got some ADL literature that claims credit for Operation Clean Sweep, that they basically put pressure on the Justice Department, said, hey, buddies, we're calling in the favors. It's time to shut these folks down.
Are you familiar with Operation Clean Sweep, the ADLs?
That's what this is all about, isn't it?
What's that?
The government trying to get rid of all these people, mm-hmm. Not only in this trial, but in subsequent trials to come. Mm.
So you are familiar with Operation
Clean
Sweep. Do you believe then that could possibly be behind this trial?
Oh, yes, very definitely, sure.
The ADL influencing
the grand jury has met in my own state of Idaho in the last couple of weeks and taken testimony for additional indictments.
I think the government's broom reminds me of a used vacuum cleaner that hasn't been repaired in years. And as they sweep the floor of all the dissenters, they're going to find the dust that they stirred up will in time bury them.
Do you believe?
Woo! That was a good one. Oh, geez. Yeah, he's good. He's good. I like him.
The Jews are behind our American government?
Not the Jews. The Zionist faction of the Jews.
In court, you testified that you coined the term Zog. Could you explain what that is or what Zog stands for?
They're having trouble today.
Well, that went way back to a movement we had about 1970, which was called the Unity Now movement, which was a Canadian and an American movement to oppose a one world form of government. We saw Zionism as the basic manifestation of a worldwide government. And we felt that they were a force that dominated the thinking in Washington. Zionism was a term that we applied to the occupational government of Washington, D.C.
Zionism.
So how many people knew that? See, this is what I mean. This is one of the reasons I do these kind of episodes. How many people knew? Press 1 in the chat if you knew where the term Zog came from, Zionist Occupied Government. Everybody here has used it. Everybody that watches this show has used this term. In chats, probably in real life, you've used this term. How many people knew where it came from? How many people knew that it was coined by Robert E. Miles here? How many people knew this? Probably almost zero. Maybe a couple like diehard history aficionados here, but I'll bet you almost none. Bet you almost none. Joseph Menard knew? I have to take your word for it, so, I mean, you could just tell me that, too, so I don't know. Yeah, press 1 if you knew, press 2 if you didn't know. Let's find out. Let's see what people knew. You know, some people might have known. I mean, if you're a real movement history aficionado, then you might have known, but I think... You know what? I'm gonna do a little Twitter poll for it. I want to see if people... I mean, again, same thing, right? People can just lie about it, but I want to see if people... knew. I don't think they knew. Weaver was the first time I'd seen it. Yeah, he had it on his shirt. It said, just say no to Zog, yeah, on his shirt. Right on, Joseph. Right on. Colonizer. Yeah, that's definitely not the case. That's definitely not the case. Yeah, I think most people, like, I mean, it's not like a gotcha. I mean, I didn't know. I didn't know where it originated from. I mean, I knew it went way back. I didn't know how where it came from. But, I mean, I just got a history lesson here, and so did all of you. I mean, maybe except for the two guys that maybe knew, but everybody else is like, wow, okay, cool. Yeah, it's interesting to find out, and it's not weird to not know that, you know? Like, I think most people didn't know that. So I think that kind of stuff is useful, and I think it's good to know where this shit comes from. I think it really is a good thing to know. A lot of people don't. A lot of people never will.
...dominated the thinking in Washington. Zionism was a term that we applied to the occupational government of Washington, D.C.
Zionism, the people are finally realizing who's behind all the dirty work that's practically ever occurred in the United States. They're finally, through men like Peters and the sedition defendants, people are being educated. And it is vitally important to the Zionists to put the educators out of business.
One of the many Christian identity pastors listed on the Anti-Defamation League's hate report is Pastor Pete Peters, minister of a Church of Christ located in the Denver, Colorado area. Pastor Peters also has a national outreach ministry teaching the kingdom identity message. I asked Pastor Peters to explain to me why the Jewish Anti-Defamation League considers his Christian identity beliefs to be a theology of hate.
The identity movement today is a movement that is crossing denominational lines, wherein people are discovering a truth, that is, that the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, and kindred people are the Israel people of Scripture. There's simply been a case of mistaken identity, and it is not these people called Jews today. Now, to say something like that will cause you to receive from the ADL cries of bigotry, racism, etc. White supremacist is something they'll label you with. However, when they themselves claim to be the people of the Scriptures, the chosen people, as they call themselves, no one ever calls them Jewish supremacists.
Identity is, and from my experience in Fort Smith, it's an idea that's been growing by leaps and bounds, and it is passing, it's an organic movement. You can't stop it. It doesn't have a clubhouse, it does not have dues, it's an idea, and you cannot kill an idea.
In the sedition trial of the 40s, as in Fort Smith, Arkansas in 1988, evidence showed that communist Zionist leaders, newspapers, magazines, and leftist radio commentators organized and conducted the most colossal smear campaign in our nation's history, designed to help convict the defendants in the public mind.
I think to understand why the media would want to do that is to, first you must identify who owns and controls the media and for what purpose.
Very true, very true. And, you know, that's kind of, it seems almost obvious, but if you really think about it, these things all are different organs of the same body. And if the media, if the interest of those persecuting these people and the media are aligned, if they're the same people, ultimately, ethnically, then the media working in tandem with the justice system to convict them in the minds of the populace before they even enter the courtroom, what happens there? Well, for one thing, it drastically increases the chance that they're actually that the jury is going to be exposed to this media as well, and that they're going to be prejudiced to see these defendants in that light. So that's a very nasty and unjust thing, but that is a reality, and this is not left in 1988. This is very much a problem of today. Very much something that happens today. They use their mass media smears and stories to prejudice the minds of the jury against the accused. So when the jury and the prosecutor and the judge, that all reads the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or whatever, and they do, they read this crap in the media, and then they go in the courtroom with that in their mind. So they're prejudiced against the accused. So in other words, you can't actually get justice in that context, could you? No, of course not.
But without question, the Jews own and control all the major media.
Yep.
Now, there might be some cases that they do not own a specific newspaper here and there, but they control then the advertising of that paper, which is the main revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And with that in mind, they use the media to accomplish their particular goals and purposes.
The Jews do.
The Jews do, without question.
The United States government and our national news media are not only making allegations against the men who have stood trial in Fort Smith, Arkansas, but also against anyone with right-wing tendencies and or Christian identity beliefs.
You can legally hate Nazis. You can legally hate Ku Klux Klansmen. Mm-hmm. You can legally hate all of these groups and get away with it. You can murder them. You can libel and slander them. You can throw mud at them. You can do anything you want to a Nazi, Ku Klux Klan, Posse Comitatus, homeschool, white survivalist, and get away with it.
Although the sedition law remains in existence, I doubt our government will have to use this law to indict and possibly convict political opponents in the future. Just as predicted in George Orwell's book, 1984, there are hundreds of political prisoners in our federal correctional institutes for thought crimes. That is, because they are looked upon by the government as dissidents, they can be convicted and sentenced to 20 years in prison under the charges of conspiracy to commit RICO.
Sedition's awful hard to prove.
What angle were they going to try?
Well, RICO is their best thing. Conspiracy to commit RICO is easy. That's a thought crime. You don't need any proof or any evidence. There's many people in prison today that there was no evidence against, but the government says, well, this person said they were thinking about doing it or they were planning on doing it, so they're in prison serving 20 years for RICO for thought crimes. They don't need proof that these people said it, only somebody who was willing to say that they said
it. Richard is right. Richard is right, and this is still very much a problem. You get a few snitches or bought-off people or corrupt people or flat-out just liars. Liars with some fucking axe to grind. And they get together and they cook up a little conspiracy to say so-and-so said this or so-and-so did this. It happens. It happens. Very, very dangerous. Why talking about these kind of things is foolish. That even goes for, like, chats, by the way. Like, Telegram chats and Livestream chats. And a lot of people will, like, engage in an edgelord competition. Be like, it's not, nothing will happen, bro. And then they'll, like, do a Fed post and they'll be like, ha ha, nothing happened. Yeah, right now. Or you get lucky and they never notice. Or you get lucky and you don't matter enough to them to cause a problem. But it's always on the table.
I understand that they're able, that the government is able to charge people through just conversation with RICO. Is that true?
Well, there's conspiracy to commit RICO. So you can talk about, not RICO itself, but you can talk with someone else about, let's say, robbing a bank, and you can still get 20 years for it. It doesn't even seem possible.
Thought crime.
That's what it is. It doesn't seem possible, does it? But it's true. I have 20 years for it. So do many of my other co-defendants.
You have 20 years for the thought crime.
Well, the conspiracy to commit.
The conspiracy to
commit. RICO, racketeering, influence, corrupt organization. Conspiracy to commit a crime. Talking about it. Prior to, not only was I convicted for the crime, I was convicted for thinking about and talking about the crime itself.
Wow.
And with the introduction and possible near future implementation of the Genocide Treaty, many fear America's future for religious liberties seem bleak.
Well, I believe that now they're going on to a much bigger concept. They're going to drop sedition in its usual form, and they're going to use the genocide treaty and the laws implementing the genocide treaty to accomplish the same thing. Now, strangely enough, they really don't need to have implementation laws for the genocide treaty. They're already doing it. It sounds as though they are going against anyone that would have the idea or the concept of destroying the Jewish race of people. That is the rationale for the genocide treaty. They don't want another Holocaust to take place. All right, so consequently, the entire genocide concept is to prevent another, what has been termed, a Holocaust. All right, so now in so doing, 50 years later, 50 years after the fact, they put John Demjanjuk on trial, and he proved unequivocally that he wasn't even Ivan the Terrible. And yet, when the prime minister came through and said that the whole purpose of this trial is to something, the fact the whole purpose of this trial is to see to it that, that the Holocaust never happens again, it was the signal that they're going to pass that cause him to be guilty, which they did. And it's a death sentence placed against this man. Now, he is as innocent as the driven snow, and yet he will be put up as a martyr. And so here now was the concept genocide, and that he was brought out for punishment for what that was considered genocide against another peoples in World War II. And yet in reality, here was genocide itself being placed on against a single Christian individual.
My understanding is the genocide that any person, group makes any derogatory statement against another race or individual, that person can be taken to a country belonging to the UN and tried for genocide. Now, that means an American citizen who says something about a Jew, perhaps, could be taken to Israel and tried in their courts under their laws.
Wow, that's insane. I don't think it quite got exactly that bad, but I wouldn't want to test the theory. Yeah, we were talking about them making examples of people earlier and doing things to have a chilling effect. This never again stuff is, it's used as a political weapon. Even against people that really have no particular designs on mass murdering Jews or anybody else per se. It's still used as a political weapon to silence people. They still use terms like incitement. That's one of their favorites. They love the term incitement. Well, technically, if it's going to be a legal thing, incitement has to be specific. It can't just be like you were expressing hostilities. It has to be directed and actionable. But they clearly wanted to push this a lot further to the point where it was just, if Jews felt threatened, that's good enough. You can't make a whole country. Well, the whole purpose of the country is to make one particular ethnic group feel safe. That doesn't even make sense. It's fucking stupid. But that's effectively what we've got now.
I don't know the penalties for that, but just the fact that we can be taken from this country, tried in another country, is something in itself. And also bear in mind that a treaty with the UN overrides the Constitution, so you have no constitutional rights when it comes to this.
Maybe they are not saying this. Maybe they are not selling this idea, but that the genocide treaty will be used for the destruction of the Christian faith. It's going to come down against Christians such as our forefathers at the time of the revolution.
you can talk with someone else about, let's say, robbing a bank, and you can still get 20 years for it.
The government does not, and for a long time, has not worn a white hat.
It's the right of the people to speak. That's what's on trial here.
The government of the United States, the Congress, and public officials are controlled by communists, international Jews, and plutocrats.
The government can afford to try you whether they have any evidence or not. They can ruin you financially.
Over 150 other political prisoners being held by the federal government.
What you had going on at Fort Smith, Arkansas, was simply one battle in this continual war between the gods, between the state and the King of Kings.
My ideas about the FBI changed pretty seriously.
I don't believe that we should have a de facto government.
We saw Zionism as the basic manifestation of a worldwide government.
Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, and kindred people are the Israel people of Scripture. There's simply been a case of mistaken identity, and it is not these people called Jews today.
I hate this government because it sets itself up in a position that's God's position.
It's an organic movement. You can't stop it. It doesn't have a clubhouse. It does not have dues. It's an idea, and you cannot kill an idea.
The government has decided that these guys are getting too outspoken, and it's time to shut them down and to destroy the movement.
My knee only bends to my God, and won't bend to these people.
Any government goes to such low and underhanded methods, it's criminal in itself. To attack women and children, a threat.
Hard to read that text, but it says, who will be the next victim of government oppression, directed by those who seek to destroy our people's heritage and our children's future? Our future must again be protected by Christian men who are willing to resist tyranny and fight to defend freedom. It's sick, Frank. It's absolutely sick. Yeah, standard policy, leverage families. Yeah, that's it. Talk about criminal. I mean, it's spiritually criminal to do that. It's like if it was a war and you grab the other people's family and use them as human shields. It's just so criminal and underhanded and dirty and immoral. Wildly immoral. I can't believe I didn't know about this documentary though, Frank. This is a pretty incredible one. And again, shout out to AB from Movement History who directed me towards this and shared me the link and stuff. Very helpful. Some really great footage in here, man. Some really awesome interviews and stuff that I had never seen before. I think I'd seen little bits of it, like some people had cut little things out and used them in other ones, but this is pretty wild. I think if you're a legitimate government, you're a government that actually truly represents the people of your country. I couldn't imagine that you would do that, that you would do this leverage families thing. I couldn't imagine that you'd have to do that to enforce justice. It seems like the kind of thing you have to do when you are an occupational government, when you're an illegitimate government that wishes to intimidate. There's nothing more intimidating than that, you know? And that's why they do it, because they know that's the case. Involve people that probably have nothing to do with it. Wow. Wow, I don't know if you want me to share that on screen, but yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I thought they would do, Frank. Yeah. Yeah. Is it all right to put that on the screen? Because it is a good example of what I was talking about how they do that to intimidate. And once they've decided that you're a racist or whatever, you're anti-black, you know, you're whatever, then they'll try to hand your children over to a black, a Negro, foster parents. And then tell the foster parents, of course, that these are the children of an evil racist or whatever. And, of course, obviously, the hopes of them taking out their ethnic grudge on your poor children. That's a sort of psychological torture, really, if you think about it. I mean, to any man, that sort of proposition that your children would be placed in the hands of enemies, or at least hostiles, that is a sadistic and evil kind of torture. Wrong. This is wrong. It's one of these things where, like, I don't know, man. Like, in a war, I don't think I would... If I was conducting a war, I couldn't see myself as... If I was a commander in a war, I couldn't see myself issuing those kind of orders. I think it's just... It's the kind of thing that's entirely against the rules of chivalry. Oh, it is in the red book. Okay, I'm only halfway through the black book at this point still. But I'm making progress. He said, Frank said that they told his pregnant wife that their unborn son would be given to a black family. The head man became the governor of that state. Wow. Ugly. Evil. Evil. And they wonder why, you know, they wonder why it is that people organize resistance to their thing in the first place. A government that would do that is inherently a hostile government, inherently a corrupted government. A righteous government wouldn't do that. They might imprison you, but they're not going to, like, drag your unborn child into it and they try to devise this sickening intimidation strategy. That is dirty, 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 dirty. And just another way to put it is, like, I couldn't imagine it the other way around, right? If there was, like, let's say you were the FBI guy, right? And you had arrested some black nationalist. And you wouldn't do that to them. You wouldn't be like, I'm going to find, like, the most racist white people. I'm going to put your little Negro children with the most racist white people I can find. You wouldn't do that. It's just... involving the children is something about that that's especially sick, mind blowing. Tugboat, hey sir, he gave 400 bolts of power, bolts of power. Hail Tugboat. On October 14, 1988. United States Senate passed bill MS or NS, I don't know, something S, 1851, implementing the laws for the Genocide Treaty. By Video Truth Network. Pete Peters died in 2011. Written and directed by Sherry Lynn Peters. I was spelling her name in the chat with an S. Photographed and edited by Stephen Ray. Engineer Bud Lewis. Additional interviews Theodore Weiland. Original music by EIF Sound. So that's pretty cool. I had never seen this one before. I think somebody had mentioned it to me in passing, but it It had evaded my radar. Wait, there's an afterword there. Research by Stephen Wright, Theodore Weiland, Laura Volmar, David Bigdis, Jody Peters, Harry Lynn Peters, Earl Jones, Lewis Hughes, and David Baxter. Another thing. There's another thing before that, too. Like an afterword there. Yeah, the documentary was inspired by and made possible by our Savior, Redeemer, Kinsman, and King, Jesus Christ. Yeah, they give an address for more stuff. We'd already take a look at that. I think we pretty much cap that up. Let me see. So that's... We didn't, though.
Federal building.
Wayne Snell had made a trip to Oklahoma City, and Wayne came back and told me about different buildings that he had seen, wanted to know if I would look at them with him sometime, and asked me to design a rocket launcher that could be used to destroy these buildings from a distance, fortified or heavy, large buildings.
Despite the testimonies, the jury fails to accept their credibility. After 7 weeks, the defendants are cleared of all charges against them.
The whole.
I was saying that this this thing with Louis Beam catching his wife is pretty cool. I mean, it probably wasn't that cool for her because she like passed out, but it was very kind of Gone with the Windy, you know. it was very like a 1930s romance movie, you know. Night Wolf, you say it's a good show, good doc. /. Well, thank you, Night Wolf. Salute you, Night Wolf, and also Mr. Tugboat, you as well. Yeah, we have always worked behind the eight ball. Yeah, of course. It's always a massive disadvantage, and there's always so many ways. I mean, they always invented new ways to screw with everybody. I think, and in some sense, though, they don't even have to. In some sense, they can just deploy the same bag of dirty tricks again and again and again and again and again. I think, you know, once they wrote the dirty trick book with COINTELPRO, I don't know that they had to really invent all that much new stuff. I think they kind of, they had the playbook as much as they needed it, and now they adapted. I bet you they adapted. Like, the internet stuff came out, they probably, you know, upgraded it, I guess, to suit that environment, but it's the same dirty tricks. They really are pretty good at disrupting any kind of dissident movement that's looking to upset the apple cart. Because they're pushing the apple cart, so. Absolutely. Thank you, Night Wolf. Boom, bullseye. Yeah, no, I got to do one on COINTELPRO. I've tried to do it before, but I think I did it kind of sloppy, to be honest. I don't think I did it the right way. I'll have to look with some of my tools. I have new tools that I didn't have then. For all their flaws, some of these AI things are actually pretty good at digging up research components that you otherwise wouldn't have found with just a search engine. So I'll have to start looking. I'd like to find some of the early footage on COINTELPRO and its deployment. You can find a bunch of like mainstream YouTube channels and stuff trying to talk about it, but it's not very good. I'd like to get a copy of their manual. I'll bet you there's a copy of their procedural manual and how to deploy these disruption campaigns. It's got to be out there somewhere. I can't believe that that's still like properly fully classified after, what, 70 years-ish, give or take? It's got to leak out somewhere.
The whole ordeal of the trial sucked the energies out of the far-right leadership. But the government fell miserably on its face and lost. And it was in the aftermath of that loss.
Oh, no, this is an after component. This is taken out of, what is this taken out of? There's another piece I'd pulled from. uploaded this separately on the same thread. I put the raw elements onto Twitter, so if anybody wants them, they can have them. I'll probably upload them into Twitter as well. I mean, YouTube as well. It's just news stuff, really. This comes from Terror from Within, a 2002 MGA film. It's an Oklahoma City bombing film. There's actually quite a few of these kind of compacted into Oklahoma City documentaries. So there's some good stuff on that. There's another one I'd gotten from. This was interesting. So this is an entire thing on HBO. This is, what the hell is this thing called? I had to screen record this. Like, I literally turned it on and screen record it with OBS to get it. It was not easy. So, hard at work for the show materials. Let's see if I can come from. This comes from something called An American Bombing, The Road to April 19th. It's an HBO documentary, I think. Yeah. So it's got some great footage in here, too. Let's see where this starts. I mean, there's a lot of this stuff is just... I tried to start it at the CSA part. And I think there's a... I didn't cut down all the rest. I just left the whole footage intact. So it's got a whole bunch of other Oklahoma City stuff because that's the actual focus of it. But kind of unfortunate because I think they also scattered some other stuff throughout that is not for that part. Can't tell what belongs where. Yeah, see, they have Elohim City there too, so they're jumping around too, which is kind of unfortunate. I had planned to do this show tomorrow, Sunday, but I was prepping for it anyway, but it ended up being an open Saturday night, so. So I might as well kick it off. Yeah, see, now they're going to do that thing where they're going to try to tie it to January 6th, as if those things have anything to do with each other. All right, let me see if I can find starts. First wave. I use this as the pre-show, actually.
Pro-gun patriotism is becoming more and more popular among economically hard-pressed farmers.
Traditionally strong, proud, independent farmers are losing their farms in record numbers.
We think as many as a million family farms were foreclosed on during the late 70s and early 80s. There was anger against the federal government's exploitation of farmers.
Violence starts to occur in the heartland. Because they were desperate. When Mr. Nixon was president, he encouraged farmers to plant fence row to fence row, and they did. But then, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, President Carter put an embargo on grain sales to the Soviet Union, and the result was the agricultural depression.
The federal government mustn't shirk its responsibility to help undo some of the damage that it created. We're doing a great deal to help farmers, but the federal government will not bail out every farmer hopelessly in debt. So today, I have vetoed this massive new bailout.
Ronald Reagan basically left the farmers to just go bankrupt. Far-right leaders saw a political opportunity. The first wave of the Patriot Movement was able to successfully mobilize farmers into this far-right movement, and they were willing to take up arms, and some of them did.
Everybody in the movement saw the land crisis, farm crisis, as the government and major corporations putting farmers into a financial bind, where the government is making war with the American people and selling us out.
I don't want to see our group or any group forced against their will into a confrontation.
I'm a former extremist from a group known as CSA, the Covenant, the Sword, and the Armor of the Lord in northern Arkansas back in the 70s and 80s. For me, it was like heaven on earth. The group was started originally by Jim Ellison to establish a community based upon the apocalypse.
God began to deal with us about the economic judgment, collapse, and upheaval that was coming upon all the world, and especially on this country.
And he said, but how are you going to protect yourself when it collapses and bad people want what you have?
Basically, the Bible says that we have the right to use whatever the enemy uses. And the enemy, of course, is going to have guns.
Fire!
We had never talked about guns before. We had never talked about defense. Over the next 18 months, we started buying guns, buying military equipment, and we trained so well that a magazine in those days called us the number one civilian SWAT team in the United States. The church kind of went to the background. Guns and the warfare went to the forefront. The first plan that we talked about was the Oklahoma City Federal Building. Sort of a quasi-member of the group, Richard Wayne Snell, he lived in Oklahoma, was having trouble with the IRS. Him and Jim went and cased the Murrah Building. There was a lot of federal offices in that building, so it seemed like a good target of various agencies being in that building. So we had our munitions guys start to develop a rocket launcher, and all the rockets would be shot at the same time toward the Murrah Building.
Jeez. Oh, that's not a good idea. That's
not
a great idea.
One of the missiles exploded in the guy's hands that was building them, scarred his hands real bad. So we took that as a sign that from God that we weren't supposed to do that particular plan.
I was surprised as to the extent of violence of this group, believing that they were going to cause the collapse of the United States of America and that they were going to help create that collapse.
Wild to see Asa Hutchinson there because he saw him earlier as a young man. He's been, what is it? He's the governor of Arkansas, I think, right? He's been in these offices forever.
We actually learned that Richard Wayne Snell,
Colonizer, he says, now we have factory farms and infinity beaners. Thanks, based Reagan. yeah, we do, don't we? Yeah, we do. Factory farms, infinity beaners. Yeah. Well, thanks for all the invaders, I guess, right? He was responsible, Reagan, was responsible for the mass amnesty thing. I wasn't good. That changed the demographics of California in a way that is really bad. And I don't know if it'll be fixed, at least not in our lifetime. I mean, this is a multi-generational Reconquista type of story there. I mean, wow. And what a thing to do if you really think about it. I mean, if you think about California in terms of the land and what it was, California was like the land of milk and honey. It was white paradise. You go back to California in the 50s. I mean, look at California in the 50s, early 60s. It was, it was a pretty awesome looking place. And the people were healthier and the crime was lower. Yeah, they did a number on it, that's for sure. And all it took was that, right? The drive of unrestricted capitalism and him being, I don't know what was his real motives actually for him accepting the or granting the amnesty bill. But it really did a number, that much I do know. It seems really, really ugly. I don't know what the motives were, but it's probably our usual friends, I'm sure, were in his ear telling him, oh, you must do this. What about the right of every humanoid on planet Earth to be an American? Come on now. Every humanoid. I mean, if they got two arms, two legs, and two eyes, I mean, they're clearly an American. That's how they operate. They actually act like that. We saw that one the other day with the Asian woman from Boston being like, everyone's an American that just hasn't got here yet. What? No, first of all. And second of all, you're not supposed to say that part out loud. It is. I'll show you.
Every person, every human being has the legal right to
come to the United States and seek asylum or shelter. And
yeah, a lot of people are seeking asylum for non-asylum things. You're not supposed to be able to seek asylum for poverty. Like, if you were going to do that, if you were going to grant, like, asylum for poverty, then you'd have the entire planet descend on your country and sink it, like a ship with too many people on it. That's absurd. That's craziness.
A member of the CSA shot and killed a pawn shop owner in Texarkana, believing he was Jewish. Had killed Lewis Bryant, a state police trooper, murdered. I believe that was in 84.
Got out of my van, and I shot Officer Bryan twice from the hip.
The death of Trooper Lewis...
Oh, wow. Oh, I didn't pick up on that at all. So it was Asa Hutchinson that threatened Frank's family. Wow. That is dirt. What a scumbag. What a scumbag. He always struck me as a Zionist scumbag, this Hutchinson guy. I mean, he always struck me that way. Yeah, there he is. What a piece of shit that guy is. I'm pretty sure. Let me look for a minute. I bet you I can find some grimy Zionism stuff with this guy. Let's see, I'll just search Agents of Zionism. There's him talking about the conflict in Israel and Hamas. I'm sure he's on his knees for Israel, there's no question there. Let's try this. Anti-Trump dude, too. God, there's got to be one of these. I'm sure there's one of these. Like, there's the one with, like, Biden where he's like, I am a Zionist. There's some time with the conflict is lost. Trump indictment. Yeah, it's not coming up with it. Let me try. Gotta be something here with this. Oh! Okay, that's worse than I thought. Oh boy, oh this is really something. Oh man, talk about a smoking gun. Good Lord.
Shalom. Last Shalom. Night it was my privilege to join members of the Jewish community in Arkansas to light the first lamp of the menorah. Each night at 5:30 for the remainder of Hanukkah, the community will gather at the menorah in front of Centennial Bank at Bowman and Chenal to light the successive candles. The light from the menorah is a tribute to the courage of a small band of fierce warriors who faced down their oppressors. Oh. As they prepared to relight the menorah lamps, they could find only one remaining jar of pure oil. Mm. Against all hope, a day's supply of oil burned for 8 days. Economic 2,000 years later, we find strength and hope in the story. The light of the menorah is the light of freedom. As you observe Hanukkah, the First Lady and I join you in your remembrance of God's faithfulness. Happy Hanukkah.
Wow, Susan got a custom Hanukkah message. Flood says, wow, fuck, it's NNR, wow. Well, fuck, it's Flood, wow. Amazing. Holy crap, it's Flood. Amazing.
Economic development, but it demonstrates that Arkansas is no place for racism and discrimination. From Rabbi Barry Block of Congregation B'nai Israel in Little Rock.
Yikes.
As a people historically targeted with horrific hate crimes, the Jewish community well understands the importance of hate crime legislation. Arkansans would be safer if such hateful and heinous criminals faced sentence enhancement on the basis of their animus-motivated crimes.
Hey, he'll sentence enhancement your unborn son, so I guess fuck you, white man.
He goes on to say, adopting this legislation will enhance Arkansas's reputation, much to the credit of the General Assembly. From IBM, IBM plans to engage
Yikes. Gross. So yeah, as suspected, I mean, I'm sure that's a long history of that sort of stuff from him. There's all sorts of stuff. He's saying he's doing an anti-racism there, basically. I'm not surprised that there's a history of this sort of servicing, if you will. Shout out to Flood and Colonizer Grindset, both there. Gross. Nasty.
Bryant was especially heartbreaking for Bill Clinton. While the governor was visibly shaken over the slaying, he was also angry.
You know, they don't have a right to go around carrying weapons and taking the law in their hands and acting as if they're somehow playing God.
Snell got the death penalty. Snell's execution was to be on the night of April 19th, 1995, which happened to be the day the Oklahoma City Federal Building got bombed. In the movement, April 19th, of course, is what's called Patriot's Day. First shot fired during the American Revolution. Very special for the whole movement. Jim told me one time, he said, I will go down in history in the second American Revolution. In 84, I told Jim, I said, so you really want all this to start? He said, yes. I said, so build a bomb and we'll start the war. So he decided to go to find a good place to do the bombing. We found the gay church. We sort of had this stereotype image in our heads that there was just going to be this sexual orgy going on, which, of course, there wasn't. I started seeing people lift their hands up and lift their eyes up, look up and start worshiping God. And I identified with them. So instantly, they ceased being homosexuals in my eyes and became Christians. And I couldn't kill Christians. Later, I'm trying to talk to God. And I said, Lord, I want to leave. You know, I can't handle this anymore. And the Lord spoke to me and said,
well, that's interesting. Well, it said April 19th is the start of Beltane, a, quote, pagan spring festival. Wow, I didn't know that. Huh. Uh-oh. Oh, I sense Kabbalah wizardry. Look out now. That's trouble. Certainly trouble, man. How dare you?
You can't leave.
It looks like a battle zone. Police and federal agents blockading the roads, surrounding the heavily armed compound of a white supremacist sect calling itself the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord. They want to arrest the leader, James Ellison, on an illegal weapons charge.
Covenant, Sword, the Arm of the Lord. They lived in log cabins. Every log cabin had a trap door. When you dropped through the trap door, you were in a foxhole with your weapon and ammunition ready. Federal officials, they really wanted to storm this compound, just like what later happened in Waco.
We knew that a frontal assault attack on that entity, a lot of people had died, and we didn't want that. I did not want that. My job is not to kill people. I know how to do it, but I don't want to do it. And I didn't want to get in a shootout in the Ozarks. They had murder on their mind, and they were all doing it for God. I found somebody I could talk to. Actually, he came to me. Kerry Noble.
He said, I want to make this plan. We are not going to shoot first. We don't want to kill anybody here. But if y'all shoot first, I've got a Huey helicopter. It's going to come up. It's got a 50 caliber machine gun. It's going to start shooting holes in all your buildings. And in 30 seconds, every man, woman, and child in your compound is going to be dead. So for 4 days, I went back and forth talking to Jim, talking to Danny. Finally, on the fourth day, Jim got that revelation that he could justify in his mind a higher purpose in surrendering. We get down there, and then Danny looks at Jim and says, I'm placing you under arrest, but I'm not going to handcuff you right now because I would not want to be handcuffed in front of my men. And I'm just bawling.
The four-day siege ended as quietly as it began. The FBI got more than it bargained for. Other weapons found at the camp read like an arsenal checklist.
All this Flood dude, I don't even know who this guy is, but he seems pretty cool, so follow him.
Hand grenade casings, blasting caps, dynamite, and various handguns.
We found cyanide in huge barrels. They were going to poison water supplies.
That's pretty crazy. If that's true, that's pretty fucking nuts. I'm not going to lie. That's definitely too much. That's definitely a lot of too much. But I don't know, man. Like, I always wonder about that sort of stuff. Like, I don't know. I just can't take it at face value. It might be true. It might be true. And if that's true, it's pretty fucked. But I don't know. Like, when they say these things, I just can't be sure that they're not making it up, framing them. I don't. Maybe, you know, maybe it's real. I don't know. It's very hard to tell. Another thing that sucks about having these kind of governments that are all crooked and, you know, full of bullshit. You never know if you can trust what they're saying to you or if they're just lying, you know, and they lie so much that it's like, what am I supposed to believe here? You know, it's just this constant thing too. It just never stops with the lying. You're like constantly trying to suss out like what's true and what's not. Are they being real? Or are they making this shit up? Are they honest? Or are they full of crap here? You know, it's kind of exhausting, really. Like, I think it's very exhausting on a population to constantly be trying to have a suss out whether or not these guys are telling the truth today or whether they're full of shit. I don't think that's healthy, you know? I think it makes the population all, I don't want to say schizophrenic, but you know what I mean? Like, kind of aggro. Aggro might be the right word. Just kind of aggravated all the time and just, you know? Think about it. You don't ever know if they're being honest with you or if they're just lying. That sucks. That's really sucky. I don't like that.
In addition to the arrest of CSA leader James Ellison by federal and state authorities,
Jim ended up taking a plea bargain on the weapons charges. Mm-hmm. I got arrested, ended up plea bargaining, 5-year sentence. Mm. My dream for moving there had turned into a nightmare, but the movement continued to grow.
The White Power movement had come together every summer at the Aryan Nations World Congress in Hayden Lake, Idaho. In 1983, the movement adopted a number of key strategies, and it decided to declare war on the federal government.
There is nothing more that the white Aryan can do but obey the commandment of Yahweh his God and separate himself.
Mainstream politics could never, ever deliver the kinds of social changes they wanted. In the 80s, there is a major campaign of violence and crime carried out by this movement across the United States. Robbing armored cars, bombings of gay theaters, assassinations.
Last night, Alan Berg was killed in ambush, arriving at his Denver home. 10.45 caliber shell casings.
It's a spree.
I should add, you know, they're saying I'm this Alan Berg guy. They always really want to focus on Alan Berg. Well, they convicted David Lane for this, but they had no witnesses. That's insane. They gave him, I think it was like 2 lifetime sentences. It's just insane. That's crooked. Same with Pierce, too. Bruce Pierce. Same thing. They gave him, like, these guys life sentences and plus for a crime that they tied them to, but they had no witnesses for. That's pretty crazy. Usually you have to have witnesses or physical evidence, right? You usually have some kind of physical evidence that ties the person accused to the crime, or you have witnesses that testify that they saw so-and-so at such-and-such place with the murder weapon at such-and-such place, right? Usually you have a body and a murder weapon and a witness.
By 1987, the government believes it has a case that all of this activity represents an organized criminal conspiracy to overthrow the United States government.
What do you say?
Charges of sedition are filed against Reverend Butler and others. In its opening statement, the government said it intends to prove that 10 of the defendants plotted to overthrow the government by force.
Seditious conspiracy is a hard charge to prove. Prosecutors have to show that they intended to overthrow the U.S. government and had the capacity to do so.
What the FBI now sees across the country is a national network of neo-Nazis and white supremacist groups whose goal is to purge this country of blacks, Jews, and other minorities.
Wow.
One, I want to praise Yahweh's holy and precious name. Two, I want to say to hell with the federal government.
Louis Beam is really the intellectual architect of leaderless resistance. And I think this has been the biggest legacy of the white power movement and the reason it's been with us since 1983. Activists can work violently in common cause without direct communication with leaders. There are still leaders in leaderless resistance, but they're not culpable because you can't trace them to the individual violent actions.
I understood that that was their intent, but I also knew that an Arkansas jury would have a hard time convicting these folks of attempted overthrow of the United States government when they had no capacity really to do that.
That's why it's called a conspiracy. The thought was trying to overthrow the government. Actually, they couldn't do it, but they certainly tried.
The government had really bet the farm on this trial. They had used all of these other busts to kind of amass state's witnesses. And it fails spectacularly.
It was the first serious setback in the federal government's war against suspected white supremacist groups. 13 defendants were found not guilty of all charges, which included murder, robbery, and conspiracy to overthrow the government.
It was a tremendous defeat for the government. And it totally enabled the far-right movement. We're free to go do whatever we want to do. They tried. They missed. We have got them by the short hairs.
Sheila Beam passed out and had to be carried off by her husband, who now walks free.
Leaderless resistance was Louis Beam's idea, and he passed it along to everybody else in the movement. The best way to go after the government was not to have this organized CSA compound, but to have individuals, which led, of course, to the term lone wolves.
I think we might go ahead and stop it there, as I think this gets off onto the whole thing with Oklahoma City and McVeigh and all this. That's not what this one is about. So I think we'll keep it there, keep it on the Fort Smith sedition trial. I think that's going to be that there. All right, well, in that case, I think that's the show. All right, well, in that case, yeah, all right. I think that this is... kind of an important turning point in how they did business. This whole part of that decade, 83 to 85, 88, that 5 years or so there, that seems to be a real turning point with them being able to dismantle, or try to dismantle, rather, the militia movements. They didn't succeed, though, right up until what? Until McVeigh and Oklahoma City. That's why I find it, well, beyond the actual dynamics of the situation there, as shown in that four-minute video. Beyond that, I find it a little too suspicious. I find it a little too convenient. They got whenever they get everything they want, now I'm suspicious. You know, there's all kinds of situations where they'll get some of the things that's on their agenda, but when they get, like, everything, like, okay, well, it's a little too convenient, you know? A little too convenient. A little weird. All right, let's go ahead and call it there. Bury my heart at Elohim City. What's this? What are you sharing with Flood? Share things with Flood. You're not allowed to do that. I clicked the wrong thing. No. All right. Let's see, what are you sharing? What are you sharing? Oh, some other thing. I don't even know what that is. All right, whatever. Okay. All right. Well, that's the end of the show for tonight. We will be back with you on Monday. I was going to do this on Sunday, but I said, hey, you know, we had an open night today. My Saturday night Blackpilled plans were canceled, so might as well have done it, right? Might as well have done it. Let's go and wrap her up. A couple thank yous, we get out of here. All right. Okay. Mr. Nightwolf. Thank you, sir. All right. Annie Waffen. Colonizer Grindset. Mr. Flood. And Mr. Tugboat. That's all the things. Is that all the things? I think that's all the things. All right, let me check this other thing, too. I believe that's all the things. Also, thank you to Hans for the other thing off the air. And with that, I think we're out of here. All right. Well, then, I say to you, good night. Have a good rest of your weekend.
Nick's Hazelnut Roast.
We are here to help decode your world.
Lap House Coffee is closed, apparently.
Truth, breaking free from youthful roof, over